Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you have joined us today. Hopefully you are done digging out from the snowfall almost a week ago. Things are getting back to normal here. Kids are back in school in Central Virginia. That is a good thing. And all the pigs are where they should be. So we shouldn't have any farm-related interruptions on the program today. Now, we do have some news. Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports is going to be with us on the program here in about 20 minutes or so. Yesterday was a busy day in the Senate Courts of Justice Committee, passing out a number of bills, rejecting a number of other gun-related bills. But as we were going through our news day here, we'd already booked Dave, and then the news broke about mid-afternoon here that Governor Terry McAuliffe, that's according to the Washington Post, Governor Terry McAuliffe, Governor of Virginia, plans to announce on Friday that Virginia will restore handgun reciprocity agreements with nearly all states in what the Washington Post Jenna Portnoy calls a stunning reversal of firearms policy that angered Republicans and gun rights advocates across the nation. So we'll talk with Dave Adams about this. Now, apparently there are some compromises that or some concessions, excuse me, as Jenna Portnoy says, that Republicans have agreed to. For instance, if an individual's Virginia concealed carry permit is revoked, a permit from another state would not be honored in Virginia. State police must be present at all gun shows to administer background checks and private sales of firearms on a voluntary basis. Anyone subject to a permanent protective order for a domestic violence offense will be prohibited from carrying a firearm for the two-year life of the order. They say the policy changes will come in the form of bipartisan legislation before the General Assembly. One of the things that the Washington Post does not mention, we'll see if Dave knows the answer to this. We might have to wait until we see what the legislation actually looks like. But there have been a number of bills introduced in the state this year that would take away the ability to set reciprocity agreements from the attorney general and would place it with the legislature. So does this agreement reached between Republicans and Governor Terry McAuliffe on the reciprocity agreements that were rescinded by the attorney general Mark Herring late last year, does this change how reciprocity agreements will be reached in the future? Again, we'll talk about it with Dave Adams coming up in just a few minutes. Also, Linda Walker, NRA board member with the Buckeye Farms Association out in Ohio, on a proposed ballot initiative in the state of Ohio. You know, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, he's running in California for governor, and he has proposed a gun control ballot initiative to go right along with his campaign. In Ohio, there is a candidate who is running for the U.S. Senate as a Democrat, who is also now proposing a similar ballot initiative in the Buckeye state. What he wants to do is to, in essence, rescind the preemption law in Ohio that has been in place for a number of years. The legislature is the body in the state of Ohio that sets the state's gun laws. So you can't have more restrictive laws in Cleveland or in Columbus, or in Cincinnati than what you can have throughout the state. It's not up to local governments. It is left again to the state legislature to set the uniform gun laws across the state of Ohio. Well, this candidate, a Cincinnati city councilman, P.G. Sittenfield, wants to, again, use a referendum or a ballot initiative to try to rescind that state law. They'd have to get 300,000 valid signatures of registered voters turned in by July the 6th. But he says that, quote, if we still fall short of the signatures we need to get on the ballot initiative this year, we will keep working to bring our amendment to the ballot next year or, if necessary, the year after that. He says this issue is much bigger than me or my campaign. Of course, you know, we'll see what the future holds here. But we'll talk about that with Linda Walker of the Buckeye Farms Association in hour two. Also in hour two, Lars Daleside, NRA ILA media liaison, is going to be with us talking about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Now, this is a law that has been on the books for 10 years, well, going on 11, passed in 2005. There is similar legislation on the books in a majority of the states. I think it's 35 or 36 states. And what this law says is that you cannot sue a firearms manufacturer or a firearms retailer for the third-party actions of a criminal. Someone uses the gun, a gun in the commission of a crime. You can't sue the firearms manufacturer for manufacturing the product. You can't use the sue the firearms retailer for selling the product as long as it was a legal sale. Now, again, if the laws were broken in making the sale, if the firearm is defective in some way, then lawsuits can still proceed. This was a response to a strategy by gun control advocates going back to the mid-1990s that sought to bankrupt the industry through lawsuits, through the filing of junk lawsuits. And the response, again, at the state level and at the federal level, law similar to the Lawful Protection of Commerce and Arms Act. Well, you know, Hillary Clinton has been looking for daylight between her and Bernie Sanders on some issues here. Can't tell the difference. Don't ask Hillary anyway. She's not going to talk about the difference between a Democrat and a socialist. She, a Democrat, Bernie Sanders, a socialist. But one of the areas where Hillary Clinton thinks that there is difference is that she opposed the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Bernie Sanders voted for it. And so she has tried to use this as a campaign issue against Bernie Sanders. Doesn't appear to be having much of an effect on the polling. Bernie Sanders continues to gain in popularity over in the Democratic primary. But Bernie Sanders is responding. He's trying to shore up his anti-gun bona fide because he is now co-sponsoring a bill introduced this week that would, in fact, repeal the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. The Hill's Tim Devaney writes that Sanders is reversing his position on a controversial gun control bill that Hillary Clinton has used to hammer him. Okay, so this wasn't a gun control bill, Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. And frankly, it wasn't controversial until Hillary Clinton decided to, again, try to use this as a campaign issue. This had broad support in both the House and the Senate when it was passed in 2005, as we'll talk about with Lars Daleside coming up next hour. But again, it's just fascinating that this is such a blatantly political move. This is political theater over on the anti-gun side of the aisle here with the introduction of this legislation. But Bernie Sanders is hopping on board, trying to show that no, he is, in fact, just as anti-gun as Hillary Clinton is. Coming up in Hour 3, we have the Deal of the Day. We've got the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Accor Defense. We've got our Good Guy of the Day. We'll also talk with Kurt Schlichter, author of, among other things, Conservative Insurgency. You have seen his columns all over the place. We'll talk about some of the big news and issues of the day, including a possible Bloomberg candidacy when we chat with Kurt Schlichter coming up in Hour 3. But we are also following all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all around the country, and we'll be talking about some of the latest bills introduced throughout the course of the program this afternoon. I do want to touch on real quick a bill that has been introduced in Hawaii. I actually heard from one of our listeners in Hawaii, George, a couple of days ago, who was talking about concealed carry licenses in Hawaii, because, you know, Hawaii is a may-issue state. Not a shall issue. You have to get permission. Even if you meet all of the statutory requirements for a concealed carry license, you still must receive permission by the issuing authority, and it is rarely granted. In fact, George said that he has found, I think, four instances of a concealed carry license actually being issued. And he said one of the licenses actually was issued for a period of time, I think it was something like 9 days, which goes beyond the statute. Statute in Hawaii says it has to be, I believe, at least a year-long period. So Hawaii, it's a state that is actually home to a lot of gun owners. The Hawaii Rifle Association has a growing membership, but it is also a state that is home to a lot of anti-gun laws on the books. And in Hawaii, State Senator Josh Green would like to put one more. Maybe two on the books. So a bill introduced yesterday at the state legislature would require gun owners to obtain firearms liability insurance from private insurance companies. He says if you have a car, you have to pay car insurance. If you're in a collision and they hurt someone else who's an innocent bystander, it's covered. Just like with guns, if a gun falls into the wrong hands or if there's an accident, just an accident, it makes a lot of sense to me that we have that extra level of responsibility. Bill Richter is the secretary of the Hawaii Rifle Association. He told Hawaii News Now that homeowners, renters insurance already cover accidents involving somebody's firearms, even if gun accidents happen outside of their home. And he said purposeful criminal activity wouldn't be covered by liability insurance of any kind. The proposal would require gun owners to renew their registrations every 5 years. Because, yes, you are required to register your firearms in Hawaii. The sponsor of the bill, again, said, imagine if someone has become blind over the years. Should they have a gun? I'd really like to see you use the argument of, well, since you've become legally blind, we get to take away your property. Would we ban them from owning a car? Just out of curiosity. Say you can't register your car because now you're legally blind. Can't own that piece of property. Seems like a very strange argument to make, but well, Senator Green's making it. He also says, imagine if someone has had psychiatric illness from drug addiction. So the 5-year renewal requirement would require, according to Hawaii News Now, 200,000 firearms being re-registered in Hawaii every year, which is about 10 times more registrations than are processed annually right now. Senator Green, by the way, says he thinks that even in Hawaii, home to a lot of anti-gun laws, this bill might require more than one session to pass. He says a bill this controversial and unique usually does take a few years. He says, I want people talking about it now so that if we have to do something, we don't do it on the fly, that we've had good dialogue. Mm-hmm. Again, the secretary of the Hawaii Rifle Association, Bill Richter, just pointed out what some of the laws are already on the books in Hawaii. He said, Hawaii already requires everybody to get a permit to acquire. You have to get permission to exercise your fundamental individual right to keep and bear arms. You have to get permission to acquire a firearm. 8-hour training course. 8-hour training course in order to purchase a handgun. Every transfer, he says, has to go through the Honolulu Police Department. But that's not enough for the gun control advocates. Not in Hawaii, not anywhere else in the United States. But with all those laws on the books already, all of the restrictive policies in place, again, people are not going to be able to get a concealed carry license. We're simply talking about all of these rules to possess a firearm in your home. The laws are still too lax in Hawaii for the anti-gun advocates. We have to make it even harder for people to become gun owners. Or to remain gun owners. We have to make it more financially burdensome to be a gun owner. Because now we're going to require that you carry an additional insurance policy. We're going to require you to pay more fees every 5 years if you would like to exercise that fundamental individual constitutional right. And again, all of these efforts are aimed at the law-abiding legal gun owners in Hawaii. You have a problem with violent criminals in Hawaii? This bill doesn't touch them. This is not a public safety bill. This is not a public safety measure. This is a measure to make it more difficult to exercise your constitutional rights. It is an anti-gun measure. And one of many that we'll be seeing around the country introduced in this legislative session. All right, so we're going to take a quick time out. We have a lot to discuss with Dave Adams, the legislative affairs director for the Virginia Shooting Sports Association. A busy day at the state capitol in Richmond yesterday in the Senate Courts of Justice Committee. And again, word breaking this afternoon that a possible agreement has been reached between Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia and Republicans in the legislature to restore right to carry reciprocity. We'll see what kind of details we can get from Dave Adams right after this quick timeout. Stick around. Just getting started on this Thursday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club. But we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain
body types. A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others, it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
I'm here at the NRA World Shooting Championship with Dwayne Liptak of Magpul. Dwayne, you guys are a major sponsor here. Thanks for what you're doing. Tell folks, what is Magpul?
Magpul is actually primarily a design and engineering company, and we've applied that at first primarily to firearms accessories, and as we continue to broaden our horizons, we've gone into other areas. But we started with the AR with one single product. Now we make hundreds of products, and we support many different firearms platforms.
And how did you end up evolving into the firearms area from this design area?
Well, no, we started with a firearms product. The very first product was the Magpul, designed by our founder and CEO, who basically cashed in his 401k and bought a mold to make one product and fulfilled orders out of his basement. And now, like I said, we're making hundreds and hundreds of products. So.
I mean, isn't it a great country when someone literally can do that? Cash in the 401k, you got a great idea, and Magpul has become like industry standard.
It's been a phenomenal journey and ride, and I'm very happy to be a part of it. So,
Dwayne, tell us about some of the other Magpul products. Give us a couple highlights.
A couple highlights. This year has been very big. We've gone into the AK platform in a large way with both the Zhukov and the Mo lines. We've also gone into bolt-action rifles with the Hunter 700 and the Ruger 10/22 platform with our X22 stock. We're also going into handguns as well with a series of Glock magazines with a lot more surprises on the way.
You're going to be a busy guy.
I am always a busy guy.
So, Dwayne, how can people get more information about Magpul?
www.magpul.com, where we have all of our products for sale, as well as all the information about upcoming products and releases.
All right, we got about 20 seconds here. Tell folks why they should check out the Magpul product.
Magpul product is because we are a design and engineering focused company, we love to solve problems in a way that benefits the consumer as far as ergonomic fit and that user experience and interface, as well as the most reliable and durable products out there, because we put a lot of engineering and time and testing behind those.
Dwayne Liptak with Magpul, thank you, sir, for being on NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
To NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program, Linda Walker talking about a proposed anti-gun ballot initiative in Ohio. Right now, I want to welcome to the program the Legislative Affairs Director for the Virginia Shooting Sports Association, Mr. Dave Adams, joins us. Dave, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam.
All right. Well, listen, when we booked you, we were planning on talking about a busy day in the Senate Courts of Justice Committee, and I do want to talk about that. But shortly before we went on the air this afternoon, Washington Post, Jenna Portnoy, with the story that some sort of agreement has been reached to restore reciprocity with most of these states that lost reciprocity with Virginia by the actions of Attorney General Mark Herring. This compromise reached between Republicans and Governor Terry McAuliffe. What do you know about this, Dave?
Our lobbyist mentioned it to me yesterday that he had a conversation with a patriot of one of the bills that was put in to restore reciprocity, that there was a possible deal in the works. At the time, he asked that we just keep that under wraps because we didn't have any details. But now, according to that Washington Post poll, it looks like we'll get the Herring order completely overturned. And in exchange, McAuliffe gets some minor concessions. But when you look at the list of things that the Post mentions, it's not a whole lot. I mean, I think basically what happened, and this was mentioned by another analysis I saw on it after the article came out, was that I think Herring and McAuliffe realized they had a huge political miscalculation in the response they were going to get on what Herring did, and this was a face-saving way of trying to deal with that miscalculation.
You know, that seems about right to me, Dave. Again, we've talked with a couple of lawmakers in Virginia since the Attorney General made his announcement. And I can tell you, people who are, you know, unfortunately for us, they're gun owners, but they're not necessarily politically active. They were politically active on this. They were contacting their representatives, and they were saying, you know, we're really bothered by this. What can we do about this? I think this did become a much bigger political issue than the governor or the attorney general thought it would be. And maybe they that comes from their lack of understanding or knowledge about Virginia gun owners and concealed carry holders. I am curious, does this what does this do for the legislation, Dave, that would take the right to carry, the authority to issue these reciprocity agreements out of the hands of the attorney general? Is that still live legislation for this session, you think?
Well, they did report Senate Bill 610 last night. They rolled several bills into that. Senate Bill 610 is sponsored by Senator Bryce Reeves out of the Fredericksburg area. That seemed to be the one that most of the legislators were leaning toward. They also reported out Senate Bill 713, which is a hanger bill, which actually creates a legislative commission. They reported that out of committee and re-referred that to finance because it may have a fiscal impact in setting up a commission and having to staff that commission. I've not heard anything about not moving those bills forward still. And it's possible that this deal that was announced in the Post is part of 610, that in return for passing and signing that bill, that the couple of other things that were mentioned, such as legislation that would keep someone whose Virginia concealed carry permit, who had it revoked, from being able to get a out-of-state permit being honored. That could be something that's dropped as emergency legislation since it's now past the date to introduce legislation, and that wouldn't make its way to the governor's desk. So we're still trying to get all the details on how all this is going to work.
Okay, and I do understand that. This is sort of a breaking news, and I think until we likely see that legislation, we probably won't know all of the details here. In the meantime, we do still have permitless carry in the state Senate. It was passed over for a vote yesterday, right?
Yes, the patron asked that it go by for the day, and he did the same thing today just before your call came in.
Okay, so we won't get a vote today on permitless carry in Virginia State Senate. It was a busy day for the Senate Courts of Justice Committee yesterday, and folks who are Virginia gun owners, by the way, you really should be following the Virginia Shooting Sports Association on Twitter. You guys were tweeting out the status of every bill throughout the afternoon. It was great to see, and into the evening as well, Dave. So if that was you or someone else with the VSSA, congratulations, because you did fantastic work.
Oh, thanks. It was a cooperative effort between our lobbyist and myself. I get the information and then I tweet it out.
So what can you tell us? What were some of the big bills that did pass out of the Senate Courts of Justice Committee? What were some of the big bills that that failed yesterday?
Well, the important bills that passed out, as I mentioned earlier, were the reciprocity bills, Senate Bill 610, which heads to the floor of the Senate, and Senate Bill 713, I believe, which is Senator Hanger's bill that's gone to finance, so it still has to be approved by finance before it can go to the floor. But we do have a mechanism that's now winding its way through. The important anti-gun bills that were disposed of, They disposed of a reinstitution of handgun rationing, one gun a month. They got rid of several so-called universal background check bills. They got rid of a couple of bills having to do with someone who has a protective order and would not allow you to be able to own a firearm. I think right now the law says you can't purchase one, but if you have one in your possession. So there's some of those bills that is the usual Bloomberg bills that have come out from the domestic violence type of things. And, you know, we saw several bills that were in for universal background checks. It was a very long committee meeting. They were taking up a lot of bills other than gun bills. It went in past 9 o'clock last night, and they started at about 2 yesterday. And also bills that had to do with disqualifying people from concealed handgun permits if they had ever had been treated for mental health or substance abuse. So we had a good night in Senate courts, and most of the bad bills that had been introduced are now gone.
Oh, that is very good news to hear, Dave. I appreciate you coming on the program. And, again, sounds like we're in for another busy couple of days here in Richmond.
We're in for a busy night over in Militia and Police Subcommittee Number 1. They're pretty much taking up the same type of bills that the Senate Courts of Justice did last night. That committee meeting starts at 4 o'clock today, so we'll be tweeting into the evening tonight as well.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, and as you learn more details about this agreement regarding reciprocity, let us know, will you?
We sure will. Thanks a lot, Cam.
All right. Thank you. Dave Adams, Legislative Affairs Director with the Virginia Shooting Sports Association, join us on the program. The Militia and Police Subcommittee 1 that Dave talked about is over on the House of Delegates side in the state of Virginia, as opposed to the action that we saw in the Senate Courts of Justice Committee yesterday. In New York last night, I almost said in Hollywood, but no, it was in New York. The Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, I believe, hosted by the Cinema Society and the Weinstein Company. There was a screening of a new Natalie Portman movie called Jane Got a Gun. What's this movie about? Well, WWD.com says Jane must defend her homestead and her injured husband against an approaching gang of ruffians. She enlists a former lover played by Joel Edgerton for help. So it's a Western. And it is, as many Westerns are, a movie that does feature individuals having to defend themselves, right, from those who wish to do them harm. But don't get the wrong idea here. Everybody involved in this movie apparently is still firmly in favor of gun control. Joel Edgerton, again, one of the actors, said that while filming, quote, I shot myself in the leg, literally, while shooting the film. He says, I was learning to quick draw, and I shot myself through the holster, blew a hole in my jeans, which also meant I blew a hole in my leg. Thankfully, he says, it was a blank. And he says, as a very laconic Australian comedian Jim Jefferies points out, it's called an amendment, meaning, I guess, the Second Amendment. It's called an amendment, so why the bleep can't it be amended? And then he paused before dropping the punchline. Hopefully someone isn't going to shoot me for my opinion. WWD.com also says that Natalie Portman also very careful to stress her pro-gun control stance. So, I guess, in the movie Jane Got a Gun, again, a woman who must defend her home and her loved ones against those who would do them harm, that's just fiction, right? These are just actors playing a role, getting a paycheck for it. But ideally, apparently Natalie Portman and Joel Edgerton would prefer that Jane didn't have a gun there on the homestead. was unable to protect her property, was unable to protect her injured loved one. That would be an awful movie to watch, by the way. Wouldn't it? It'd be a pretty short movie, too. Defenseless Jane and her injured husband can't really defend themselves against that gang of ruffians intent on doing them harm. You probably actually cover that entire plot in about the length of a trailer. And I don't think many people would go see that movie. Because it's not a fiction that we have a human right of self-defense. The more compelling story is one in which we can protect ourselves. One in which we can protect our loved ones. That's the story that we want to see. Not just up there on movie screens or on Netflix, but that's what we want to see in real life, too. We want to live in a world and in a country in which we can protect ourselves. As for Joel Edgerton's comments, you know, I try not to get my political thinking from comedians because, first of all, who knows where they've come up with their thoughts, right? And they might have just taken it from somebody else. But if you want to amend the Second Amendment, try it. Go out and do it. Go. Start a campaign. Start your petition. Go. Say you want to repeal the Second Amendment. Actually, don't just say it. Try to do it. But I confess, I am confused. I am a little puzzled as to how somebody could. I understand you get the paycheck. Great, whatever. But how do you attach yourself to a project? How do you get into that role of someone who is, let's say Jane, because apparently Natalie Portman, again, stressing she's still very much in favor of gun control last night. How do you get into that role and portray somebody, again, who is defending herself, her home, her loved ones, and then not think about that, apparently, not actually ponder what it means to have that right of self-defense, to simply, again, shed off that role when the filming wraps, and to not give a second thought to the principles and the philosophy, the mindset behind that film. I guess I'm not. That's why I'm not a professional actor, because it just strikes me as weird that you could, again, play that role and not take anything away from it. Not have it impact your opinion or your point of view one iota. But then again, you'll never see me at the Oscars. All right, we got to take a quick time out. When we come back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, we have more of the day's top stories, including the latest in Nebraska on the fight for preemption, plus Missouri taking up the issue of campus carry. Stick around. We've got more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Dale Pancake with the Italian Firearms Group. Dale, welcome back to NRA News. What is the Italian Firearms Group?
Well, the Italian Firearms Group is a group of four companies that are operating here in the United States now. We have the Sabati Firearms, like you see here in front of you. We have Pedersoli, which are the replica Old West-style firearms. We have the Fair Firearms, which is the Rossini shotguns and rifles. And then we also have the Tangfolio, some of the Tangfolio products.
How did this particular organization come about?
Well, we were visiting with the Italian group, which those four businesses in Italy are friends. And so they approached us at one of the shows, and over a period of a couple of years, we decided we want to be part of that organization.
That's pretty cool. So tell us a little bit about, first, about the Sabati. What do they specialize in? What do they do?
Well, Sabati is very well known in Europe and across the world outside of the United States for their rifles. The Sabati rifles hold most of the world records, especially all the European records. their tactical rifles, which are on the table here, are used by many of the foreign military organizations. And so we have started bringing them in. We're going to reintroduce them here to the U.S. and try and make them a household name here.
So, Dale, there's four different companies in the Italian Firearm Group, but the ones that we have here are the Sabati ones. So let's talk about these firearms. They're aesthetically striking. They're beautiful firearms, but I understand they're very functional, too.
Absolutely. These rifles you see here are kind of a representation of the different lines that we carry. We have our tactical rifles. We have our varmint or target rifles. We have our hunting rifle. We have our scout rifle. And so, you know, what you see here is a pretty fair representation of our bolt action line. The barrels are going to come in a heavy barrel for tactical use, a less heavy or a medium contour for, hunting. You can use them for whatever you want. And then, of course, our lightweight rifles that you'd carry all day.
Right. This is a bit of a rifle to carry.
It is. These are very heavy. You know, this rifle, for instance, weighs about 13 pounds without the scope on it, and it is a tactical rifle specifically designed for police, law enforcement, and military. This one is in .308. We offer these rifles in .223, .243, .308, each of these rifles in the different variation. The barrel in the taper, you can order in any of the rifles. You can order it in the stainless or in the blue. The other thing you'll notice on this rifle is we have our adjustable comb and length.
Speaking with Dale Pancake with the Italian Firearm Group, so what are some of the features of this particular rifle?
Well, on this particular rifle, you'll see that it's in stainless steel, first off. It has adjustable comb, adjustable length, a pull. The triggers are adjustable. It features, this is a .308 caliber, and in our .308s, we offer a brand new feature, which is called a multi-radial rifling. It's a exclusive feature to Sabati. It increases the actual velocity 10% or more over standard rifling. Easier to clean, stabilizes the bullet much quicker upon exit from the barrel. So you have an inherently accurate rifle right out of the box.
So these are all the Sabati ones. We'll talk a little bit about the other products. Who are the other folks in the group?
We have Fair, which are our shotguns and double rifles, and those are made in Italy by Isidro Rossini. We offer also in Sabati, we offer our over-under shotgun, our double express rifles, and we also offer Petersoli, which is the Old West style reproductions.
So, Dale, for someone, these names are new to them, why should they be checking out these particular brands in the Italian Firearms Group?
Well, they're all very high quality made. You can look at any of our different lines. They're all top drawer. They're all exceptionally accurate. They're reliable. When you get one, we never have a return because they really have good quality control to factory. We have good availability now here in the United States. We have a warehouse here. It is totally stocked with all of our models. So you can get anything you see in the catalog, you can get it immediately.
Dale Pancake, thanks. How do people get more information about the Italian Firearms Group?
Well, you can go to our website, which of course is italianfirearmsgroup.com. And from there, it's very simple to click on any of the lines that you're interested in. It'll take you direct there and give you our information.
Dale, thanks for so much for what you do. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is NRA News, Cam and Company. The frozen Potomac. We'll be up near the frozen Susquehanna here before too long with the Great American Outdoor Show kicking off on February the 6th. We will be there broadcasting Monday and Tuesday. We'll have a live presence there throughout the entirety of the Great American Outdoor Show. I'm really looking forward to it. A lot of our friends are going to be there. Hopefully you will have a chance to make it to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for at least a couple of days. And you probably will need more than one day to make it through the entirety of the Pennsylvania Farm Show complex. I would schedule two, maybe three. And there are going to be all kinds of great events taking place throughout the Great American Outdoor Show. In the evening, there are going to be concerts. You've got the NRA Foundation Banquet, which if you are a fan of Friends of NRA dinners, this one is like the biggest Friends of NRA dinner that you've ever attended. So there is, again, a lot of cool stuff that will be taking place in Harrisburg throughout the entirety of the Great American Outdoor Show. And hope that we'll see you there in Harrisburg before long. Now, I did want to get to some of the other Second Amendment news stories around the country. Again, a lot of legislatures are back in session now. They are dealing with both pro-Second Amendment as well as anti-Second Amendment bills. In Missouri, lawmakers are taking up the issue of campus carry. A Senate committee, according to the Kansas City Star, hearing testimony on Wednesday on two bills that would expand the availability to carry a firearm on campus. One bill would permit a school to ban concealed firearms only if it posts armed guards and metal detectors at every entrance to every building on campus. In other words, unless you have a hard target, then with security in place, then you have the right to protect yourself in those facilities that do not have security. The other bill would allow anybody with a concealed carry permit to bring a gun onto campus, but certain areas such as large stadiums and places of worship, the Kansas City Star says, would still be exempt. Now, Kansas, you remember, has passed its campus carry legislation. That goes into effect in 2017. Texas passed its campus carry legislation last year. It goes into effect for four-year public institutions in August of this year, and then will go into effect for community colleges in the Lone Star State in 2017. So we are seeing more discussion. They're also talking campus carry in Florida right now, and hopefully we will see more progress on campus carry throughout the country this year. Now, in Omaha, the preemption bill that was before the unicameral legislature apparently is done for the session after a filibuster by State Senator Ernie Chambers, who has been a longtime anti-gun advocate there in the Nebraska legislature. And the filibuster by Senator Chambers apparently one vote short of overriding that filibuster. And so preemption is not going to come to pass, it looks like, in this legislative session in Nebraska. Now, they're also dealing in Omaha with another story, not dealing with statewide preemption, but dealing with a very local gun ban. In fact, one courtroom in Omaha, Nebraska, that has banned firearms. There's a judge in Douglas County that has banned firearms from his courtroom. And this has come to an issue because this applies to everybody other than the deputies that are working security in his courtroom. This applies to police officers, for instance, who may be going into that courtroom to testify in a trial. And as a matter of fact, that is what happened. There were two police officers on Tuesday of this week who said they were supposed to testify in a robbery trial. They said that they did not feel comfortable removing their service weapons and going into the courtroom unarmed. The prosecutor in the case was concerned that if the officers did not do as the judge demanded, that that they would be facing contempt charges and could possibly wind up behind bars. And the judge was not moved. The judge said that the gun ban still applies. And the prosecutor in the case actually ended up having to go through the hearing without the testimony of the officers. Now, in this particular case, there was enough evidence that had been gathered that the testimony apparently was not of essence to the case, but this is still something that can come up in the future. The Omaha World Herald, the local paper there, had an editorial today in which they bemoaned the status quo, said that all sides should reach a compromise. Of course, they didn't say what that compromise should be. In the meantime, this very local gun ban, again, one courtroom, is getting major attention now throughout the state of Nebraska. The other 12 judges there in Douglas County have all signed on in support of a statement that says that the sheriff should be the court officer that sets the security measures for the courthouse and all of the courtrooms in the courthouse. In other words, these judges are telling the judge who's instituted a gun ban, we don't think it's your place to do this. You have the mayor of Omaha coming out and saying that she is not in support of what this judge is doing. But you also have the city attorney in Omaha who has now made statements saying that, yeah, he thinks that the judge is within his power to ban firearms from the courthouse there. It could be, according to the media there in Omaha, that the Nebraska Supreme Court is going to have to take up this issue. There are apparently two different rules, there in the state of Nebraska that the Supreme Court has issued as far as security guidelines. One seemingly leaves the security measures, again, in the authority of the county sheriff. And the other seems to leave the authority for the security of a courtroom in the hands of an officer of the court, I believe is the phrase there. So what is pretty clear is that the one-man gun ban in the judge's courtroom, not particularly popular outside of that one judge's opinion. But whether or not the Nebraska State Supreme Court will weigh in here, and it looks like if the ban were to be rescinded by anybody other than the judge, it would have to be the Nebraska State Supreme Court. That is still very much an open issue. I should also mention as well that among those sounding off, I mentioned the mayor as well as the city attorney there in Omaha, but the police union is also talking about this as well, the Omaha Police Officers Association, talking about the ban in Judge James Gleason's courtroom. They're not pleased, as you can imagine, with the ban that is in place there. They believe that the officers should be able to continue to carry their duty weapon when they are there in the courthouse. Now, again, the two individual Omaha officers who refused to surrender their firearms could have been jailed by the judge had they taken the stand with their firearms still on their persons. But apparently a very contentious meeting of the Douglas County judges this week, the Omaha World Herald, said that several judges described the meeting as cordial, even as the gun ban came under fire. Apparently, Judge Gleason reportedly asked his colleagues if this was, quote, really the hill you want to die on. And he apparently declined to comment to the paper when he was asked whether he would alter his ban. Several judges said that Gleason indicated to them that he would not drop his ban, asked if he would alter course if the Supreme Court adopted the rule proposed by the other judges there in Douglas County. Gleason said, I won't speculate. So this has been blown entirely out of proportion, but as a practical matter, he says, I'm not going to make any further comment. I mean, you actually had a situation earlier this week in the Douglas County Courthouse where there were, as the Omaha World Herald describes it, four judges waiting out in the hallway outside of Judge Gleason's courtroom, just kind of looking to see if these police officers were, in fact, going to be arrested because they wanted, again, to have their service weapons on them while they were in the judge's courtroom. I can understand, again, why the Omaha World Herald will come out with the editorial saying this is silly, just resolve this, find some sort of compromise. But the Omaha World Herald doesn't mention what that compromise would be and where that compromise would come from. Again, it seems like maybe a compromise isn't possible here. You have a judge who says no guns other than those carried by the deputies that are stationed in the courtroom itself. no firearms, no police officers testifying in court can have their firearms with them. That's his position. The position of the police officers, at least those who were called to testify on Monday, is that, no, we believe that it's important that we have our service weapons on our persons, and we don't want to take them off. Where do you find the compromise in that? I mean, it seems to me that if as long as the judge wants this to be the policy in his courtroom, and the authorities greater than the judge, the Nebraska State Supreme Court, doesn't issue some sort of a ruling or guideline on this, you're asking that the judge simply take back what he said. That's what you have to do. The judge has to admit that he's wrong, or the police officers have to admit that they are wrong, and that there is no public safety benefit by having more armed law enforcement officers in a courtroom while they are testifying in a case. But one of those sides is going to have to say, all right, we give up. Because I don't, what would the compromise be? They could have their firearms with them as long as they were behind the bar. When they took the stand, they had to surrender. I mean, what sort of compromise is the Omaha World Herald calling for here? I don't know that there is one. Again, I think we have two competing points of view. The judge's position that his courtroom will be safer if there are fewer firearms there in the courtroom, and the police officer's position that the courtroom will, in fact, be safer with more armed law enforcement officers there in the courtroom. Now, I guess the only question is left up to the state Supreme Court as to whether or not the judge has the authority to do this. We'll keep our eyes on what's going on there in Douglas County. I'm fascinated by the ban on the carrying of firearms by law enforcement officers. It actually, this might be part of a trend here. I did see a story earlier today talking about why we should ban guns from police officers. You know, we've seen this put forth a couple of different places. The New Republic had that article a few weeks ago, ban guns for everybody, including most police officers. Noah Berlatsky has this piece at QZ.com, The Case for Disarming America's Police. He writes that there is a broad consensus in the U.S. today that local police forces need to be demilitarized. In the summer of 2014, the country watched as citizens protesting the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, were confronted by local law enforcement SWAT teams bearing body armor, military-grade rifles, and armored vehicles. The spectacle helped prompt President Barack Obama's administration to restrict transfers of military weaponry to local police departments. But he says ending police access to armored vehicles is one thing. Taking guns out of the hands of the police is another issue altogether. And one that apparently Noah Berlatsky thinks should be made. Now, he does say the idea of taking guns away from police is likely to receive a highly skeptical response, even from people concerned about the problem of excessive force. In a nation with so many millions of guns on its streets, Noah Berlatsky writes, both legally and illegally, asking police officers to give up their own weapons presents a logistical and practical quandary. Lewis Hayes is a working police officer in the Chicago area, said that there is, quote, simply too much violence being committed by criminals with firearms to even consider an unarmed police force in the United States. He said, I doubt there is a community, a city, a local government, or a police union in the entire nation that would seriously consider disarming its protectors. You know, I bet, I mean, not to discount Lewis Hayes' comment, but I bet there are some communities out there. Mayor of San Francisco, Mayor Ed Lee, has talked about wanting to try to get away from firearms in the hands of police officers, talked about more non-lethal means. I bet Tacoma Park, Maryland, if the Now, obviously, again, the officers wouldn't go along with this, but I think there's probably majority support on the city council to disarm the police there in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Maybe Berkeley, California. But Berlatsky says that yet there is some evidence that disarming the police might be less dangerous than it sounds. According to statistics compiled by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Berlatsky writes, of the 27 law enforcement officers murdered in 2013 in the line of duty, only six were able to fire their weapons at assailants. Another two were killed after their firearms were stolen and used against them. Berlatsky says, note, several dozen other officers were also killed while on duty during this time, the majority from car accidents. In many cases, he says, it seems arming police officers isn't a black and white issue of officer safety, especially since the FBI's Uniform Crime Report reports that 461 people were shot and killed by police in 2013. So you've got Berlatsky tossing out a couple of statistics here. But when we come back after a quick timeout, we need to put those numbers into perspective. And we need to talk about some of the numbers that Nor Berlatsky didn't mention in his quest to prove that disarming police is inside the realm of possibility. Stick around. We'll be back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this.
Speaking with Chris Brackett of Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak, and that is on Outdoor Channel and also Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing amazing.
Well, we got a lot to talk about, so let's get started. First, tell folks, what is Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil? What's that all about?
So Fear No Evil is a deeper, darker look at why any crazy person would sit in a tree from dusk till dark and do all the things that we do as hunters. And, you know, sometimes you find yourself just, why am I doing this? I'm sitting here and I'm freezing to death. But it's a, you know, deep, dark look at big game hunting, and it takes you on a roller coaster of emotions. Most people say, you know, our show's different than others. Ours really, we try to capture a 30-minute movie. So each one is different than the other one, and you know, some of them may be funny, some of them may make you cry, other ones, you know, takes you on a roller coaster, and it, you know, the industry is a change in that way, and we wanted to really make a one where your wife will sit down and watch, you know, and she doesn't watch normal hunting shows.
And I think that's great, Chris, because it's good to get inside the mind of a hunter, because most people who don't hunt look at them going, why in the world would you want to do that?
Yeah, you have different classifications of different outdoor television, right? You have entertainment, you have education, and then you have this kind of, you know, the kind of the old standard of, okay, here comes a deer, cutaways, this and that. And
right.
and everybody likes one for a different. And
right.
for years, for the last 10 years, we just decided to make it completely organic in its own art.
So tell me, and I know we could probably talk about this all afternoon.
Right, I love it. Yeah.
What is it? Where do you get that passion? What can you tell people in 30 to 40 seconds here why you do what you do? Why is it so, to the non-hunter, so great?
For me, it's absolutely, it is in my blood, number one. I can't not go after something. Number two is that, you know, God kind of put it on me to inspire and educate through entertainment, and that's my mule. That's my entertainment.
That was excellent. So that's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak. That's on Outdoor Channel. Now let's shift gears with Chris. Let's talk about Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. What is that all about?
So Arrow Affliction is the almost opposite of Fear No Evil. Fear No Evil is this dark. It's almost like, you know, you love chocolate ice cream, you love vanilla ice cream. Well, it's kind of the lighter side of bow hunting. Fun with arrows, shoot everything, hunt the way you and me got a BB gun and did everything that we could think of as 10, 12-year-olds, and now we're grown men doing the same thing with arrows, hunting bullfrogs, ducks, doves, geese, pheasants out of the air, just shooting and you know, and really pushing yourself.
So is it tough for you, Chris? I mean, that's a lot of plates to spin, a lot of balls to juggle to have those two TV shows in production. Does it get tough?
Yeah, and we went a different route. You know, I was born and raised in the Midwest, and I'd had nothing, and I created it from nothing. So it truly is an American dream being able to do this. But at the same time, what everybody really has to understand is that I don't have any kids. I don't even have a mortgage on a house. I rent a house. I give everything to my art to inspire, to educate all the viewers. And so for us to do it, we're on the road, you know, most of the year. I started in September 1. I just ended 5 days ago killing a giant Boone and Crockett deer in Ohio. And I've devoted my entire life for everybody else to enjoy the adventures that we go on.
Your passion is total. It's all out.
it's full throttle, man.
It's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak on Outdoor Channel and Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, how can people get more information about Chris Brackett and about your great shows?
Well, the best way is you can go to fearnoevil.com, the website.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, starts right now. Sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Coming up on the program this hour, we'll talk with the Lars Daleside, NRA ILA Media Liaison, about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Linda Walker of Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors, is going to join us here in just a moment, talking about a proposed ballot initiative in the state of Ohio. And then later in the hour, we'll get back to our discussion about the quest to disarm the police, this piece at QZ.com. Just a couple of things here before we move on. We'll come back to this later in the hour. I mentioned that there were a lot of statistics, or a couple of statistics, that the author of this piece at QZ.com, Noah Berlatsky, threw out there, saying that, of the 27 law enforcement officers that were murdered in 2013, only six of them were able to fire their weapons at assailants. So if only 6 out of 27 officers could return fire, well, that means that we should get rid of police officers carrying firearms generally. I'm not sure that, you're going to find that a convincing line of argument for civilians, much less police in this country. Berlatsky, again, compares that to the 461 people, he says, who were shot and killed by police in 2013. Now, he doesn't explain or say how many of the 461 officer-involved shootings were justified. He just throws that number out there. The case for disarming police actually gets weaker the further down the story you go. But we'll pick up the conversation and the discussion about the quest to disarm our nation's law enforcement in just a few minutes. I do want to welcome to the program right now NRA board member with Buckeye Firearms Association, Linda Walker. Linda, how are you today? I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. It's been a while.
I know. It has been a while. We need to catch up.
indeed we do. And there sounds like there's a lot to catch up on. This obviously is an election year.
Yes.
And in Ohio, a candidate for the Senate over on the Democratic side is trying to differentiate himself, it seems, by pushing for a ballot initiative in Ohio, Linda, that would undo the firearms preemption law that that you all have there in the Buckeye State.
Yeah, it would pretty well undo everything that NRA has worked for years in Ohio. A little background, March 14th, 2007, preemption went into effect. And what that did in Ohio, we had 80-some municipalities across the state that had some form of gun control. So if you're going to drive from corner to corner of the state, you literally would have had to have read all of the ordinances on all of the, you know, towns and little burgs that you were going to go through to see if you were going to violate their gun laws. And preemption brought it all under one rule, whereas now I can literally drive from Cincinnati to Columbus to Toledo and know that all of the gun laws are uniform. And this gentleman who's running for U.S. Senate, I don't want to say his name because he's not known in Ohio. He's a young guy who sits on Cincinnati's city council, and he truly would be one of Hillary's favorite people because they're uniform in what they want in gun control. And this ballot initiative that he's talking about would actually become a constitutional amendment to the Ohio Constitution in the remote chance in which it would pass, he's going to need to collect 300 signatures.
300,000, right?
And I think June, and which would be pretty tough. July 6th is the cutoff, and I ask everybody, you know, I'm generally one who, you know, here, let's put it to the people, let them vote on it, but this one truly smacks the U.S. Constitution and the Ohio Constitution in the face.
Well, and, you know, you just look at some of the provisions that were in place before preemption, right? I mean, you had, let's start with Cleveland, if we can, for a second, because I recall even after preemption was passed, the mayor of Cleveland vowing that they would have their local gun bans on the books, regardless of what state law said.
Yeah, we actually, part of the preemption bill was that if we ever had to sue a municipality because they were violating preemption, and Cleveland prior to that had voluntary gun registration, who voluntarily registers their guns, but they proceeded to continue to arrest people for having not voluntarily registered their guns. So we actually sued them and took them to the Ohio Supreme Court, and they lost, and they had to pay attorney fees because that was part of the preemption bill. But, you know, Columbus had the assault weapons ban. If we all remember back, NRA's annual meetings were going to be held in Columbus, oh, I think in 2008 or 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, NRA books out the convention center several years in advance. And at the time, Mayor Coleman, who is gone now, he was going to implement the Columbus assault weapons ban, and NRA and Wayne told him, don't do it or we'll yank the convention. Well, they did it, and NRA yanked the convention. And so there's just far-sweeping consequences of something like this passing. I mean, literally, Ohio, again, would go from a pretty good state for gun laws to being pretty bad again.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, again, the usual suspects would be leading the way, and I'm sure with even more restrictive laws than were on the books in the first place. And you know, I've got to ask, I mean, were these laws, Linda, primarily directed against violent criminals, or were these laws used against, you know, legal gun owners who happen to be driving through Cleveland or Columbus on their way to somewhere else, and then, you know, maybe pulled over for a traffic stop, and all of a sudden now they're face-to-face with this local anti-gun ordinance?
Exactly. I mean, as we know, most gun control laws affect the law-abiding citizen, and we're the ones who will obey the laws. I've never seen a law-abiding criminal.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, right?
It is.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you keeping us up to date on this issue. How are things going in the legislature this year?
I was down to the State House yesterday morning. House Bill 48 had sponsor testimony only in the Senate. This is Representative Magg's bill that passed with full bipartisan support in the House a few months ago. This one, it's going to loosen up. It will allow, like, carry in daycares. It will allow carry in the unsecured side of airports, private aircraft. Literally right now, if someone who is a pilot or an airplane owner in Pennsylvania and they want to fly to Indiana, if they're crossing Ohio, which they would, we need to tell them you can't land in Ohio in your private aircraft because that would be violation of our law. It will also allow college campuses to opt into concealed carry. And like I said, it was only sponsor-only testimony yesterday, so we've got a ways to go yet. And watch BuckeyeFirearms.org or NRA ILA alerts for updates of when hearings will be. I know there will not be a hearing next week.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, Linda, it's great catching up with you, and look forward to seeing you in Louisville, if not before then.
I shall be there.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it. Linda Walker, NRA board member with Buckeye Firearms Association, joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, with the latest out of Ohio, including the proposed ballot measure. You know, I started the show today saying that most of us had dug out from the snow from almost a week ago, but CBS in Baltimore with a story today about Baltimore residents getting a little ticked off that here it is Thursday, and they have yet to see a single plow come down their street. Say the block over one side, that's plowed. The block over there, that's plowed, but not us. We are still stuck in the snow in Baltimore. Washington Post saying that some folks in the Northern Virginia area still not dug out. I've got to ask you, Cameron, because I know that earlier in the week you guys still hadn't been dug out. Did the plows actually ever get to your neighborhood in Alexandria?
It was hard to get out on, I guess it was Tuesday. I couldn't get out. Our private, our homeowners, whatever, they plowed this little alley behind our house, but then to get to the street, it was completely snow covered. So I kind of questioned why they even bothered. So I took an Uber in, and, you of course know this area very well. It's usually pretty easy to navigate, but there was, the snow was so narrow on the streets. Everyone was driving really slow. People were just cursing each other. I mean, seriously, last time I drove in Manhattan, I hadn't heard this much cursing and honking here in Old Town Alexandria. And then, of course, after I get to work, my wife tweets me a picture of the snowplows coming down the street. So we were okay, and the melting helps too. But nothing surprises me in Baltimore, of course.
Right. So for the past couple of weeks, by the way, I've been binge watching The Wire. I don't know why it took me so long to watch The Wire, but it did. I think because when The Wire came out, I didn't have HBO. But I've been binge watching The Wire. I can tell you, it sure seems like not much has changed as far as the management of the city goes since, the show ended in 2008. Seems like all of the problems are there, and in fact, probably gotten worse. But Mother Nature is probably going to help those folks in Baltimore before the city of Baltimore will. Hopefully, the weather's supposed to be a little bit warmer this weekend, and those poor folks stuck in their homes, not able to drive down the road. What now? Sunday morning. That was Sunday. Sun was out. So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Maybe by next Sunday. Maybe a few days from now, the snow will have melted to the point that these folks can actually get on the road again. Now, coming up in about 20 minutes or so, Lars Daleside, NRA ILA media liaison, is going to be with us on the program. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this piece at QZ.com on the idea of disarming police in the United States. Noah Berlatsky, the author of this piece, he has put his best argument forward. I just don't think it's a good enough argument. We'll talk a little bit more about it coming up right after this. Stick around. There's more NRA News, Cam and Company on the way.
Speaking with Jose Morales, NRA training counselor. Jose, welcome to NRA News. We want to talk about the three rules of firearm safety. What are those?
Thank you very much for having me. The three NRA safety rules. The first one, the primary rule, is always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Now, what that means is we want to make sure that if that gun discharges by accident, that it's in the safest direction possible, the direction it will cause if the gun were to discharge, the least amount of property damage, the least amount of possibility of injury possible. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we never point the muzzle, which is the front of the barrel, at anything we don't want to shoot, including ourselves.
Okay. Rule number two.
Rule number two is always keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to fire, which is common sense, but as my mother says all the time, common sense is not that common. We need to make sure that our finger in my pretend gun is on the side of the gun, away from the trigger guard at all times. And our finger only enters the trigger guard when we're ready to shoot, and as soon as we're done, it's removed immediately and always kept alongside of the gun, preferably on the frame.
Okay. And what's rule number three?
Rule number three, always keep your firearms unloaded until you're ready to use them. So the moment you pick up a firearm, you have to make sure that if they have any manual safeties, they're engaged. Open up the action, remove the magazine, visually and physically inspect to make sure that there's no rounds in the chamber, and then you are ensured that the gun is empty.
Jose Morales, NRA training counselor, let's go over those three rules again. Number one.
Absolutely. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Number two is always keep your finger off of the trigger until you're ready to shoot. And number three is always keep the gun unloaded until you're ready to use it.
All right, the three rules of firearm safety. How can we get some more information about this?
Just check on nrainstructors.org for a comprehensive list of classes, and we'd love to see people take more of them.
Jose, why is it important that we observe these three rules of gun safety?
As I tell my students and gun enthusiasts and budding gun enthusiasts, guns are incredibly safe. We are the ones that are unsafe. We are the ones that make accidents happen. And if you follow all three safety rules all the time, not when you remember, not when you feel like it, but all the time, it is literally impossible to have an accident.
Speaking with Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. Dan, welcome to NRA News. Tell us, what is Hire Our Heroes?
Yeah, so Hire Our Heroes is a nonprofit organization that basically helps transitioning veterans to position themselves for employment as they get out of the service.
Why'd you start this, Dan?
I served in the Marine Corps Reserves, and after 8 years, I got out thinking I had this great skill set. I was a satellite communications specialist, and shortly thereafter, long story short, there was really no opportunity for me to really find employment or anybody to help me find employment. So I felt like I was on an island by myself, and I thought if I couldn't be the only veteran going through this, that there was probably a need for a greater reach. And lo and behold, I gathered a few other veterans, and we formed Hire Our Heroes, basically founded by veterans for veterans.
That is great. So what's the reaction been to Hire Our Heroes?
You know, it's been phenomenal. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. The response has been overwhelming at times. But it has been nothing short of great and rewarding at the same time. There's nothing but opportunity for us to help veterans. And believe it or not, there's a lot of nonprofits out there, and these veterans still have a tough time really finding the right one that's going to bring them down the path to success as they transition out.
Dan,
we feel like we've got a pretty cool tool set to do that.
Awesome. Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. How can folks get more information about the great work you're doing and your great organization?
Visit us on the web at hireourheroes.org, and they can fill out information on whether or not they're interested in transitioning, reaching for somebody to reach out for them to connect, as well as some of our other services and that we offer.
Dan Caporelli, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. You're listening, and perhaps watching, NRA News Cam & Company. Thank you for doing so. Sponsored by Nosler, as always. Lars Daleside coming up here in about 20 minutes or so. But as we're discussing this article at theqz.com, this is a piece by Noah Berlatsky on why we should disarm police officers. I thought, why not actually talk to a former police officer? So John Cardillo joins us on the program, former New York police officer. Got a show on WJNO in West Palm Beach, Florida. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, and as of Monday, syndicated on CRN Talk.
Oh.
You can get me every day, 12 to 2, Monday to Friday.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
And I'm glad to know that you're off the air at 2, so that will not impact your ability to appear as a guest on NRA News Cam & Company, which
begins at 2. No, I'm
going
to be plugging
you
guys and telling everybody to listen after me.
Well, fantastic. And, you know, if you ever need a guest, just let me know.
Always.
So there is this piece at QZ.com, Noah Berlatsky, making his best case, John, for disarming police officers, saying that, you know, if we, first of all, let's go through the arguments. First, he says,
Of the 27 law enforcement officers murdered in 2013 in the line of duty, only six were able to fire their weapons at assailants. Another two were killed after their firearms were stolen and used against them. So since a majority of these officers apparently could not use their firearms to defend themselves, why not simply get rid of the firearms carried by officers in the first place?
What a moronic thesis. I mean, let's take officers Lou and Ramos, killed in New York City last December. They were ambushed from behind and shot in the head. Just because a cop doesn't have the chance to use his weapon doesn't mean he doesn't need it. And living proof of that is Officer Jesse Hartnett in Philadelphia, who was ambushed by an ISIS loyalist but was able to step out of his vehicle, engage in a gunfight, and stop the assailant. So if anything, it proves the need for armed police officers, probably better armed police officers.
Okay, then he says, well, then there's the global precedent. He says other nations have had success in disarming police. And the examples he cites, John, I have to tell you, they're not really examples of nations disarming police. They're examples of locales where police have never really had firearms. In England and Wales, he says, where officers generally do not carry firearms, police didn't kill anyone between March 2012 and March of 2014. In comparison, he says, New York City police shot and killed 16 people in 2012 alone. He points out Iceland, police in Iceland routinely patrol unarmed, he says. And so, you know, why can't we be like Iceland or England?
Well, in Iceland, everybody's freezing cold and there are like 11 people, so it's horrible. Police, as an example. But in England, people also had the privilege of watching another Islamic terrorist hack a soldier to death in the street. And because of the incredible lack of firearms there, the overwhelming lack of firearms, no one could render assistance, even police officers who had to run and call for armed response units. And if we look at what happened yesterday or earlier today, actually, because of the time change, a guy was arrested in gun-free Disneyland in gun-free Paris with a gun, a lot of ammo, and a Quran. And so I think, if anything, the case is becoming stronger for armed police globally.
All right. So far, you seem to be getting the better of Mr. Berlatsky in his arguments here. All right. He says, okay, well, what about even if mass disarmament, he says, is a political and legal impossibility right now, there are other options. As a first step towards changing law enforcement philosophy, Gregory Smith-Simon, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, suggests that police departments consider disarming police officers when they are not at work. So in other words, John, as soon as you're off duty, hand in your service weapon, and you better not have one at home.
And I'll point to Canada, where they were doing that. And if you we don't see a lot of press on this here in the U.S., but Canada has a much larger problem with outlaw motorcycle gangs than we do in the U.S., threatening police. And one of the reasons, if you talk to Canadian law enforcement, is because when these officers work in undercover units or gang enforcement or intelligence units, the OMGs, the outlaw motorcycle gangs, know that they're historically unarmed after hours, and cops are suffering as a result. And so they're very quietly – they're examining a policy change the other way there, allowing their off duties to carry.
Interesting. There was a suggestion by a police officer from Chicago who said, all right, well, how about this? What if we had unarmed, non-sworn positions, commonly called community service officers? He says that these types of officers can handle, quote, many of the lower risk non-emergent calls that burden so many police forces. In other words, which to me doesn't sound like that's part of the disarm the police strategy at all. It sounds like that's more of a, hey, how do we get more manpower dealing with these non-emergency calls so that the sworn officers, those in uniform, those not in uniform, can actually handle the major cases. Which again, to me, sounds like this police officer from Chicago is trying to politely suggest to Mr. Berlatsky that he's barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, and look, they exist, right? New York City has an auxiliary police force that handles noise complaints and traffic conditions, things of that nature, and they're unarmed. They're not sworn law enforcement. And so those units are already in place in large departments and many in small departments. But again, there was a white paper I read recently. I'll actually forward it over to you because I think you'll find it interesting, written by a retired New York City police captain and a very good friend of mine. He's a criminology professor, but he's a reserve deputy.
Okay.
And it basically made a very strong argument for arming these auxiliary units, because oftentimes that noise condition is much like the quote-unquote routine car stop. When these unarmed cops get there, they face something much more deadly, much more dangerous, and they're getting hurt as a result. So I think the argument for unarmed cops has been thoroughly debunked. Let me add one last fact, Cam. In New York City in 2014, according to the annual firearms discharge report, in 25.5 million interactions with the public, the New York City Police Department only discharged their weapons 79 times. It was basically one in 330,000. They only killed eight people. So one in 2.7 million interactions. I broke it down, and a black man in New York City had a chance over the course of his lifetime. He was 7.3 times more likely to be struck by lightning in the city than he was to be shot dead by a New York City police officer.
Interesting. But, you know, again, I mean, as you say, John, it's the millions of interactions every day that you know, proceed as normal, whether they end in an arrest or they end with a have a nice day. Those aren't newsworthy. Even the sheer mass of numbers, even that number, that figure of 25.5 million interactions is not considered newsworthy by the media. What is considered newsworthy is the interaction that goes wrong, the interaction where an officer has to draw and fire their service weapon, an interaction in which that might not be justified. That's the only newsworthy interaction that we see. And so we don't get that context. We don't have that baseline of, okay, how many interactions were there where, again, the firearm was never drawn compared to those interactions that that did lead to an officer drawing their service weapon. If we don't have that baseline comparison, are we really just reacting emotionally to this issue?
Yeah, I think we are, right? But again, and look, I can't even indict the media on this. And you and I are both, you know, we constantly indict left-wing media. But to be fair, it isn't newsworthy to say, hey, the police gave somebody directions and they got there faster, right? Mm-hmm. That's not newsworthy. And it is what the police are supposed to do. But I do think the context is very important, because without it, it does appear police are out there gunning people down for no reason. But when you do look at the sheer numbers of interactions, that interaction could be anything from that, crossing the street for someone or giving them directions, to a felony response. When you look at the sheer number of interactions, the amount of times police fire their weapons is almost statistically zero. I'm not trying to downplay anyone being shot, but I'm saying that statistically, we have the most restrained professional police in the world here in the U.S.
Talking again with John Cardillo, former New York police officer and the host of the John Cardillo Show, now syndicated noon to two on your radio dial. You know, and to that end, it's interesting that, you know, you go back to the countries that Mr. Berlansky pointed out here, England, Wales, and Iceland. There was no discussion about, you know, police in Mexico, for instance, disarming.
Right.
Or places that maybe Brazil, you know, they've got a sky high homicide rate, always have. Maybe that would change if the police were to simply give up their firearms. You know, it seems to me, and I think to a lot of other people, that you know, the reason why Noah Berlansky, I think, is kind of on the defensive here in this piece is because it really is an absurd proposition to go tell a police officer who is out there patrolling in a dangerous area every day, you're actually going to be better off if you don't have your firearm with you.
Oh, I think you'd see, if that ever happened to me, it never would, but hypothetically, if it ever did, you'd see attrition to fire departments and federal agencies like you've never seen. No one would want to be a police officer, because then it really would be suicidal to take the job, which in some places cops make good money, but by and large, they don't. They make just under the median. And so you're not going to take a job that's definitely putting your life at risk, not just possibly putting your life at risk. It simply wouldn't happen. We would have our crime problem would skyrocket to the point where it would affect both national security and our economy.
So why is this idea still at least semi-popular in some quarters? We did see the New York, not the New York Times, but the New Republic a few weeks ago putting out a piece as well saying it's time to ban guns. Yes, all of them, including for most police officers. Where is this idea coming from if it's not coming from the bulk of Americans, is not coming from law enforcement itself? Who's pushing this idea?
Well, I mean, we know who's doing it, right? It's, I mean, you said it, a sociology professor at Brooklyn College, one of the most liberal institutions in one of the most liberal cities, and a spokesperson from arguably the most liberal department within. So, of course, the New York Times and the New Yorker and the New Republic love this guy. And I think we have these far-left academics who have the luxury of living in naively idealistic stupidity where they believe there's no crime. It's like these documentaries of Making a Murderer and the glorification of Mumia. These academics, these far-left academics, look at criminals and romanticize them as Robin Hoods. They don't realize these are savagely brutal people who enjoy hurting innocents. And that's the danger of, I think, liberalism and progressivism, is that they glorify these savages and try to make them. And I use that word, and that's not – there's no racial connotation on that. I think Jeffrey Dahmer was a savage. He's the whitest guy in the world. But liberals love to glorify and romanticize these people, and they lose sight of the fact that they're very real victims. These same liberal academics who call for disarming police, have you ever seen one of them interview victims of crime and get their perspective? Never. They don't do it because they don't want the real story to come out.
No, I think that's very true. And you know, unfortunately, and John, I mean, you know this, as a guy who spent a lot of time on the streets, and we've talked about this before, you know, even in the worst neighborhoods, most of the people living there are good people. And yep. you can be poor, you can be down on your luck, you can struggle with addiction. That doesn't make you a murderer. Right. When you decide to take that step to become a violent criminal and for a lot of violent criminals, unfortunately, that's not a big step for them to take. It's not something that they wrestle with. This is something that they slide into. But again, even in the worst neighborhoods, you don't have a majority of people living there that have made that decision. Most of the people living there are living in fear of those predators who are preying on them.
Oh, absolutely. And I can tell you, I mean, I take my old command, the 4-6 precinct, still high crime. We've always talked about this, right? Maybe 6% of the neighborhood is criminal. The rest are 94% of the people who are working poor, who are working long hours, riding public transportation. Go ask those people if they want unarmed police officers responding. I guarantee you. And the 90 percentile will look at you and say, are you out of your mind? You know, get those cops here as fast as you can with as many rounds of ammo as you can.
Yeah, well, I would imagine that many of those folks would also say, and while you're at it, hey, how about relaxing the laws so that I actually can exercise my right, too?
Absolutely. 150%, absolutely.
Well, listen, John, I appreciate you coming on the program. As you said, I don't think that we are in any danger of this yet. But I you know, listen, I do think in places like San Francisco, where you've seen the mayor call for police officers to have more non-lethal means, whether it be a taser or something else. I think that there are some locales out there. You're right. I don't think the officers themselves would go along with it, but I wouldn't be surprised if we actually see politicians in some very deep blue areas begin to really push this idea.
That's why whoever the Republican nominee is, vote for them, because you're voting against the Bernie Sanders type people of the world. I said to somebody else, not a lot of things scare me. The idea of who a Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton would appoint to the Supreme Court or any kind of oversight, it terrifies me. It gives me nightmares.
Well,
you just pointed out a reason.
You saw the question asked of Hillary Clinton earlier this week. Would you appoint Barack Obama to the Supreme Court, right?
Yep. It's terrifying. And her statement, which I'm sure your audience was all over. I saw it on Twitter, where she talked about the things that you should have a firearm for, collecting, hunting, but target shooting, but self-defense wasn't among them.
It never has been. I don't think it ever will be for Hillary Clinton. That's what the Secret Service is for, John.
That's right. That's right. Our detail, you know, in the gated community.
Right. All right. Listen, buddy, thanks again for coming on the program. Congratulations on the syndication move, and I hope we can get a chance to talk to you again soon.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd love you to come on the show. As a matter of fact, I'm hoping you will.
Let me know anytime. I'm available for you.
You got it, my friend.
All right. We'll talk soon. John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show. Now, not just on WJNO in West Palm Beach, Florida, but weekdays. How about that? Always like to see our friends do well. Lars Daleside, NRA ILA Media Liaison, is going to join us in just a couple of minutes. But, piggybacking on what John had talked about as far as Supreme Court nominees, Hillary Clinton, yes, a banner week for comments by Hillary Clinton. She was in Decorah, Iowa, and a... voter asked if she would consider nominating President Obama to the Supreme Court. She said, quote, "Wow, what a great idea. Nobody's ever suggested that to me. Wow, I love that. Wow." No pandering involved there, right? No. He may have a few other things to do, Hillary said, but I tell you, that's a great idea. Said he's brilliant and he can set forth an argument. And he was a law professor. He's got all the credentials. Is that the credentials? Brilliant. You can argue. You had to have been a law professor. So I think we have quite a few justices that are on the Supreme Court who were never law professors. She said, now we do have to get a Democratic Senate to help get him confirmed. So you are going to have to help me on that. Hillary Clinton has definitely been talking up the fact that the next president is likely to nominate perhaps as many as three Supreme Court justices during their term. So Hillary has already said, I think she's open to Eric Holder on the Supreme Court, now open to Barack Obama on the Supreme Court. We know the types of judicial candidates, apparently, that Hillary would be nominating to the Supreme Court if, in fact, she were to be elected. So I would imagine that's a motivating factor for a lot of voters out there. At least I would hope that it would be. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Lars Daleside, NRA ILA Media Liaison, will join us to discuss the bill, which became law more than a decade ago. Now, anti-gunners, including Bernie Sanders, are trying to undo that piece of legislation. Stick around. We have much more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
With Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female, and it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NRA training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor, and I came back and started this, and it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania, and they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things, and that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women, because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways, totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit, whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you're handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely, and that's actually one of the draws about my class, is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them, and everything is different. And it's funny, I have a video out that akins the firearm to buying your bra, if we can go there on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
But, and I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, I got you a 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like,
no.
Guys are like, honey, try this big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay. I'm a PA guy myself, and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from
That's
here.
Awesome. So why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but you went way beyond. I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. And I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there, from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Kelly, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Coming up, top of the hour, we've got the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense, our deal of the day, a local deal from Central Virginia, as well as our good guy of the day. Right now, I want to welcome to the program NRA-ILA Media Liaison Lars Daleside is with us. Lars, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Cam. How are you?
I am good. You've recovered from SHOT Show. Did you make it back relatively okay?
I made it back. I was originally supposed to come back on Friday. I landed at Reagan National Airport on Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
The only saving grace to the whole thing was that, thankfully for the weather, most of the snow had melted off my car, and getting her out wasn't that big of a problem.
See, your story right there is why I left early, because I just knew that would be me if we didn't leave when we left. We would be there for a couple of extra days. Well, I'm glad that you did make it back home safe and sound. And, you know, interestingly enough, we've got a bill introduced in Congress. Even the sponsors are admitting it's not likely to go anywhere. But they're introducing this for a reason. On the Democratic side of the presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton has been going after Bernie Sanders for not being anti-gun enough. And one of the things that she keeps hitting Bernie Sanders on is his vote in favor of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act in 2005. Well, now Bernie Sanders says, I'm co-sponsoring a repeal of this bill. So let's talk first, Lars, about what the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act actually is, what it does, because there's the federal bill, but there's also similar legislation in dozens of states around the country. In fact, those states passed their state version of this before Congress even approved the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act a decade ago, right?
Yeah, well, what happened is one of the firearm manufacturers, they were facing a numerous amount of lawsuits, somewhere around 30 from a bunch of anti-gun municipalities who basically were just trying to burden and bury them in legal fees. And I'm sure the end all result was hopefully a little bit of bankruptcy there. And what the PLCAA did was actually put them on the same standing as almost any other class out there, which is saying that you can't sue a manufacturer when somebody illegally uses their product. I mean, in a sense, it'd be sort of like going after Ford if a drunk driver runs over somebody. I mean, it's not Ford that did that. It was the person who was actually behind the wheel.
Okay, but if Ford makes a car that has a defect and they knowingly put that product out there on the market, you could sue Ford for that. Could you do that with a firearm manufacturer?
Yes, you can. The current law allows that to be just the same. I mean, there is no special blanket immunity that they're talking about. I mean, in fact, when you look at what like Senator Kaine and Blumenthal, some of the others, what they're trying to do with this law is actually doing what they say the law currently says, is they're creating a special liability class for gun manufacturers and dealers, where the only thing that this did was make sure that everyone was on the same footing.
Okay, and now we're hearing, and you know, it is worth noting that what we're hearing from Hillary Clinton and even Bernie Sanders about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, they make it sound, Lars, like there is this blanket immunity, right, that you can't sue a firearms manufacturer, you can't sue a firearms retailer for any reason whatsoever, that they're just immune from lawsuits.
Well, Hillary Clinton hasn't been that shy with the truth when it comes to firearms and a lot of the things that she likes to talk about with her various loopholes that have been proven wrong time and again. And this is just another example. It doesn't fit the agenda, so she doesn't bother following that. And she's more than happy to make these wild accusations to try to scare the pants off of people when, in fact, there's nothing to be frightened of.
So what would this new legislation do exactly, the new anti-gun bill that's been introduced in Congress?
Well, the new bill overall, what it does is it would put firearm manufacturers and dealers at the mercy of these different anti-gun municipalities and groups that decide that they want to go after the firearms industry. There are going to be negligent suits that come out there that don't have any basis in tort law today, or ever for that matter. And they're going to tie them up with legal fees and tie them up in court and eventually, as I said earlier, try to go through and bankrupt them.
Okay. Now, again, I don't expect that this bill is going to see a lot of traction legislatively this year, but do you get the sense that that's really not what this is about, that this is about messaging for Bernie Sanders and the other anti-gun senators who are behind the bill?
I think this is a little bit of messaging up in New York. You know, we have our favorite anti-gun mayor, Michael Bloomberg, and he's been pushing all sorts of anti-gun agendas all over the United States. You know, we see it up in Maine, we see it out in Nevada, and this is just a little bit of his playground now here in Congress and just trying to push another area of the gun control agenda out there.
All right. Well, listen, Lars, I appreciate you coming on the program today, sir, and I look forward to talking to you again very soon.
All right, Cam. Thank you very much.
You bet. Lars Daleside, NRA ILA Media Liaison, with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Yeah, all kinds of signaling and messaging going on here. Hillary Clinton, we were talking with John Cardillo last segment about Hillary Clinton's, among other things, John mentioned Hillary's comment in Iowa this week. And here's the actual quote. She said, "Here's what I want you as a gun owner to understand." Okay? So if you're a gun owner out there, here's what Hillary Clinton wants you to understand. "We've got to keep guns out of the hands of people who don't use them for hunting or shooting practice or collecting. We've got to keep guns out of the hands of people who don't use guns for hunting or shooting practice or collecting." Again, absent from her list of people who should own firearms were those who own firearms for self-defense. Hunting, collecting, and shooting practice. Everyone else, apparently, Hillary would like you as a gun owner to understand that we have to keep guns out of the hands of those people, those who might carry a firearm for self-defense. Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton would also include those who would carry a firearm illegally, those who would use a firearm in the commission of a violent crime, as most gun owners would include those individuals. But again, the, 13 million concealed carry holders, for instance, that we have in this country. No mention of that group of Americans by Hillary Clinton. Hunting, shooting practice, or collecting. But not defense of yourself. Not defense of another. And that's what Hillary wants you as a gun owner to understand. I mean, she said this. She wants you to understand this. Remember, this is also the candidate who told a fundraiser in New York that she thought the Supreme Court got it wrong in the Heller case. That there is no individual right to keep and bear arms. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court decided, that there was one. So if Hillary Clinton says that the court got it wrong in that case, then one can only assume that Hillary Clinton does not think that there is an individual right to keep and bear arms. And again, the court in Heller said that the core purpose of our right to keep and bear arms is self-defense. Well, if Hillary Clinton thinks that the court got the case wrong, one can only assume that she doesn't think that the core purpose of the Second Amendment is self-defense. In fact, she doesn't think that that's a purpose of the Second Amendment at all. Just hunting, collecting, and shooting practice. You know, it's interesting because of all of the things that Hillary Clinton has said. You know, look, she's not going to go after the Obama administration in any way, shape, or form. But you can, again, look at the number, the declining number of federal weapons prosecutions that have occurred under this administration. For a long time, for most of the tenure of Barack Obama in the White House, the worst jurisdiction in the country as far as federal prosecutions of weapons violations was Chicago, or at least the district that included Chicago. Lowest number of these types of prosecutions. They've bumped up a little bit, but they are still not leading the pack by any stretch of the imagination, even as the violence in Chicago continues to get worse. And the other aspect of this is, again, if you want to keep guns out of the hands of people who don't use them for hunting or shooting practice or collecting, or even, let's just throw in self-defense, is the best way to do that, the best way to prevent people from illegally acquiring, illegally carrying, illegally using a firearm in the commission of a violent crime, is the best way to go after those folks, laws that are aimed at law-abiding gun owners. You know, again, in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., in Baltimore, Maryland, New York City, and virtually every other locale across the country, you've got a small group of offenders, very violent offenders, who are responsible for a disproportionate amount of violent crime. Now, those individuals have lengthy criminal histories. They are well known to the court system. They are well known to the cops in their neighborhood, and they are well known to the community that they live in. Everybody knows who they are. The problem is doing something about these individuals. Because the criminal justice system tends to gobble them up and spit them right back out on the street a short time later. We're going to talk about this in today's Deal of the Day, because it happens all over the place, even in a state like Virginia, where supposedly you get convicted of a felony. We don't have a parole system. You're going to do 85% of that sentence before you are eligible for release. Sounds pretty good. But even then, there are ways to game the system. And there are ways for people to turn into career criminals without ever facing real consequences. And when you have a small group of offenders who are disproportionately committing violent crimes, and they continue to do so, you are not interrupting that group. You're not either taking them off of the streets or turning them away from their criminal activity. What's going to happen? Violent crime is going to continue. You can pass all of the gun control laws in the world, and your violent crime is going to continue, because those violent criminals aren't touched by another gun control law. They're not impacted in any way, shape, or form. You know, I reference a book every now and then on the program called Don't Shoot or Stop Shooting, David Kennedy's book, about the Boston Miracle and about the ceasefire initiatives to, again, go after these most violent offenders. And he tells an anecdote fairly early on in the book when he was still in Boston. This is back in the mid-1990s, was right after the Brady Bill passed. And somebody came to him and said, you know, aren't you happy about this? Isn't this going to be great? We've got this gun control bill. And David Kennedy said, this isn't going to affect our violent crime at all, because the people who are using the guns in the commission of violent crimes are not going to a gun store to get their gun. They're not acquiring them legally. So you can have whatever kind of restrictions you want on the illegal gun owners, but don't expect that that's going to have much of an impact on the violent crime rate. In Boston back then, and today as well, in many cases, you are dealing with individuals who are obtaining their firearms illicitly through friends or family, on the black market, through theft. Many of these individuals aren't old enough to legally purchase a firearm. So another gun control law aimed at the law abiding will not touch that individual. Won't impact them at all. But it will impact the tens of millions of Americans out there who do own firearms, whether it's for hunting or for shooting practice or for collecting or for, yes, self-defense, defense of family. That's who's going to be impacted. Whether it is the city of Seattle's tax on every round of ammunition sold, every firearm sold, the proposal in Hawaii that we were talking about requiring every legal gun owner to purchase firearms liability insurance and to pay another government fee now on a five-year basis as opposed to a lifetime registration of firearms. These measures, again, are aimed at legal gun owners for a reason, because it's not about public safety. It is about making sure that there are fewer legal gun owners out there. And the only reason why anybody would could make the argument that, no, that's still a public safety piece of legislation, is if you truly do believe that fewer firearms in the hands of law-abiding legal Americans will make us safer. And if you believe that, then you must accept that as an article of faith, because that certainly isn't what the data has shown for the past two decades. Data has shown, the statistics have shown, that over the past few decades, our violent crime rate has been dropping. Well, at the same time, our gun ownership and the number of privately owned firearms in this country has been climbing. That's not an article of faith. That's just the data points. All right, stick around. Coming up, top of hour three, we have the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, our deal of the day, our good guy of the day, our friend Kirk Schlichter, and more. We'll be right back with much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Joe Fiala with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. Joe, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for stopping by. You got a lot of stuff going on. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you do in the Governor's Office of Economic Development there in South Dakota and why you do it. So tell us a little bit about what the office is all about and what you have going on.
Sure. So we're all about growing business in the state or attracting business to the state. And in my specific instance, I get to work with all of the companies in the shooting, hunting, and outdoor industry. So everything from firearms and ammunition to duck calls and fishing rods.
Wow, Joe, can we say dream job here?
Yeah, you can.
And it's great in South Dakota. There's an office to do this. Because, you know, Joe, in some states would say, I won't mention names, you know, it's okay. Maybe we'll keep you at arm's length. We love your taxes. But you guys are showing in a very overt way here, welcoming industries like this.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a good fit for the state in a couple of ways. And here's a couple of examples. We've got about 850,000 people in the state. And we issued 350,000 hunting licenses last year.
Say that again. Hold on.
Yeah. So we've got about 850,000 people in the state, and we issued 350,000 hunting licenses.
Wow, dude, that is incredible.
Yeah. So this industry is a really good fit for the state. It's just culturally what we do, who we are.
Yeah, and you know, Joe, we're talking. Let's talk about that for a minute. I just was talking with some other folks here, and for people who are non-hunters and don't understand, it's part of a lifestyle, you know. It's part of, you know, who we are and what we do.
That's exactly right. You know, I grew up hunting with my dad and my mom, and we'd go out hunting, and now I get to teach my kids that same thing.
Right.
And it's about family time. It's about, you know, hunting for your table.
Yeah.
In some instances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's about the sportsmanship.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Joe, I grew up in Pennsylvania. hunting's big there the day after Thanksgiving when I grew up. It wasn't about going out Black Friday and shopping. It was going out deer hunting.
Exactly.
Or you grew up in South Dakota. That's just part of what our, you know, our DNA is. Speaking with Joe Fiala, he is with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff, some of the folks who have you've been working with. Name some of the companies.
Right. So, you know, some of the South Dakota companies that have been longtime residents that continue to grow. You hear Dakota Arms.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly. Black Hills Ammunition.
Absolutely.
Corbon Ammunition. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got some of the players that have been around a long time. One of our newest corporate citizens to the state is a company out of Pennsylvania. It's called Lehigh Defense.
Okay,
I've heard of them. Yep. They are expanding to the state. And so it's a great fit. They're going to make bullets, and we'll use them.
Dude, how great is that? A company in Pennsylvania is expanding out to South Dakota.
Right.
How great is that?
Right.
All right, so we got about 30 seconds here, and then we have to wrap it up. So I want you to sort of give folks the message why they need to be, if they're in those particular industries you mentioned before, why do they need to bring their business to South Dakota?
Sure. A couple of things. One, we're a very low-tax state, which means we want the business owner to keep their money. Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah. Second thing is Forbes rated us number one as the lowest cost of business state in 2015.
That's nice, too.
Right. So it doesn't cost a lot to do business. And then the cultural fit that we talked about, it just works. And we want to grow that business in our state.
How can people get more information about what you do?
Right. They can go to our website. It's sdreadytowork.com.
Okay.
And then for my specific industry, you put a slash and shot.
Joe, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program, in the next 60 minutes, we have our Hero of the Day, brought to you by Adcor Defense. Also, the Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day. Kurt Schlichter is going to join us on the program. We'll also talk about a rather disturbing data point that could indicate that violent crime is on the rise. It has nothing to do with gun ownership, legal or otherwise, in this country. But we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Right now, I do want to get to our Hero of the Day, sponsored by our friends at Adcor Defense. Today's story from WCAX-TV in Montpelier, Vermont. A burglar held at gunpoint at a home in Montpelier. I wonder what Bernie Sanders is going to say about this. WCAX reports a frightening experience for a family in Montpelier early Wednesday morning when they held a burglar at gunpoint. City police say 27-year-old Jesse Fitzgerald of Hyde Park broke into the home on Gallison Hill Road. Homeowners awoke, confronted Fitzgerald heading upstairs, and the husband held him at gunpoint while the wife called 911. Police say that Fitzgerald fled the home, but as officers arrived, he actually went back inside the residence. WCAX says after some tense moments, officers sent their canine in, and officers were able to capture 27-year-old Jesse Fitzgerald, the homeowner, holding Fitzgerald at gunpoint, acting in self-defense. Not going to be facing any sort of charges there. And this, you know, really is the most common type of defensive gun use out there. The defensive gun use in which the firearm is never actually fired, the trigger is never pulled, but the presence of that firearm is able to stop a crime from proceeding any further or able to prevent that crime from occurring in the first place. So our Hero of the Day from Montpelier, Vermont. Now, our Deal of the Day from the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Mark Bowes reporting on this story. Front page on the Times-Dispatch today. What's bizarre is that they did not tweet the story out. They're tweeting out reviews of restaurants in Richmond, but this story apparently not worthy of the Times-Dispatch actually sharing on social media. A felon released from prison 6 months ago who was wanted in last week's killing of a man in Amelia County and the abduction of his wife. They don't know where 68-year-old Olin Brooks is. They are fearing the worst, unfortunately. This felon, released from prison 6 months ago, shot himself on Wednesday in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, as police closed in to arrest him, according to authorities. 43-year-old Dana Williams was found by the U.S. Marshals Service Fugitive Task Force about 9:10 Wednesday morning there in Fitchburg, Mass., which is where he is from. They attempted to arrest him. Instead, Dana William, who was armed, shot, and critically wounded himself as officers prepared to enter the residence. The suspect does remain alive and is in critical condition. The Times-Dispatch says authorities are now focused on locating 68-year-old Olene Brooks, who police said William abducted after killing her husband, Woodell Brooks. Police say that William took friends and family hostage last Thursday near the Brooks' home in the 1700 block of Poorhouse Road in Amelia County. Police found Woodell Brooks bound and dead in the couple's home, and Dana William left the area after taking Olene Brooks hostage. Apparently, William was married to a daughter of Olene Brooks. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that Dana William was released from prison a little more than 6 months ago after serving 2 years and 2.5 months for one count of rape and 5 counts of violating a protective order. 2 years and 2.5 months. 2 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks, and he's out the door. He was convicted in Chesterfield County, Virginia, on April 22, 2013, and he was sentenced to 40 years in prison for the rape. Now, again, I mentioned Virginia doesn't have a parole system, so you're supposed to do 85% of your sentence, at least, before you're released. Well, 2 years is not 85% of 40, so what the hell happened? Well, the judge in this case suspended 38 of the 40-year sentence for Dana William. He also suspended 11 months of the 12-month sentence for every one of those violations of a protection order. A violent sexual predator gets the vast majority of his sentence suspended, which means as long as he keeps his nose clean behind bars, as long as he doesn't assault a guard, doesn't assault another inmate. And once he gets out, if he keeps his nose clean, he doesn't have to go back to prison. What happens if you don't keep your nose clean? Well, then you will have to go back and face not only these new charges, but you might have to go back and fill out the rest of your sentence. You might. William was released to community supervision July 6th of last year. He was required to register as a sex offender. He was entered into the state database in May of 2003, a month after he was convicted in Chesterfield County, Virginia. And 6 months after he's released from prison, a suspect in a murder and an abduction of a 68-year-old couple in Amelia County. I am hoping that the reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Mark Bowes, might be able to get some comment by that judge there in Chesterfield County as to why 38 years of a 40-year sentence was suspended for a rapist. Why 11 months out of the 12-month sentence this guy received for violating 5 orders of protection, or at least 5 different violations of an order of protection. Why the vast majority of this man's sentence was suspended, was simply declared null and void as long as he kept his nose clean. In the meantime, Dana William of Fitchburg, Massachusetts, and Virginia, today's deal of the day. Our good guy of the day from WTSP, the story of an officer who came to the aid of an elderly couple after they were the victims of a credit card theft. Officer Douglas Gaddis in St. Petersburg, Florida is the man, and Debbie Poole and her husband James Poole, the victims of this credit card theft, met Douglas Gaddis Wednesday afternoon. Didn't plan on meeting the officer. James Poole had just been released from the hospital. He had spent the last several months receiving care after several strokes. So they're driving home from the hospital. It's a happy day for the couple. And Debbie realized they're almost out of gas. So pulls over, stops to fill up at a Shell gas station. She says, I was getting the gas, and the card wouldn't work. And so James asked a guy who was standing around, can you help us? He said the man took the card, started asking a lot of questions. Is it a debit card? Is it a credit card? What's the PIN number? Yeah. And James Poole says, I no sooner said what the PIN number was, and he just took off running. Debbie Poole said she thought immediately, we're screwed. So they call the police. Officer Gaddis got the call. He responded to the scene. He said, when I got there, the Pools were just very upset. And this upset him. He said he decided he had to do more than just take the report. Now, James Poole, I mentioned, has some trouble recovering from a series of strokes. He has some trouble speaking. But Officer Gaddis called the bank himself, canceled the couple's card. He got out his credit card, paid for a fill-up for the couple. Debbie Poole says he put gas in my car because he knew I didn't have any money, and he really helped us. She says he went above and beyond. He really did. And Douglas Gaddis says, I don't consider this above and beyond. He said, these are people that needed help, and since day one, I wanted to help people. Officer Gaddis has been with the St. Petersburg Police Department for 15 years. And Debbie Poole says, quote, it is good to know that there are people left like him. It is indeed good to know that, Debbie, and we certainly give a tip of the cap to Officer Douglas Gaddis there in the St. Petersburg Police Department for being one of the many good guys out there. It's a, I can understand how that could, you know, affect somebody. I mean, look, if you're a police officer, every day you see, hopefully you see the best in people. More than likely, you end up having to see the worst that society has to offer. After 15 years on the beat, I can imagine that, you know, you may have seen it all. And you, one would think that you could become numb to this sort of thing. And after all, you know, I'm sure that Officer Gaddis has rolled up on some scenes where there were elderly victims who had far worse crimes against them than a credit card theft. You know, it would be easy to become numb to a simple story like this where a couple just had their credit card stolen from them. You'd think it would be easy, but clearly not everybody becomes immune to these types of stories and these types of incidents. And when an officer like a Douglas Gaddis does roll up on a call like this, and he talks to these real victims, these real people, it is good to know that the heart hasn't been hardened to the point that it's just another report to file, just another case that may or may not go in the black and get solved. And chances are, I wish this couple the best, and I hope that they do find justice, but chances are they probably won't ever recover that card. They probably won't ever make an arrest in this case. Thankfully, the card was canceled, and hopefully this guy wasn't able to make any purchases. But I think it really, if Officer Gaddis says it was not going above and beyond to do what he did, I'll take him at his word. But that does make me feel, I have to say, even better about the men and women protecting and serving our communities out there, that we've got officers who don't consider this to be going above and beyond, to dig into their own pocket, to fill up a stranger's tank of gas, to help them make sure that their card is canceled. And then, and only then, to start filling out the paperwork that comes with the responding to this crime. So, again, Officer Douglas Gaddis there in St. Petersburg, Florida, thank you, sir, for being one of the good guys out there. Now, Kurt Schlichter is going to be with us later on in the hour talking about some of the big news stories of the day. I do want to mention, while we've got a couple of minutes here, the latest article, or the latest issue of America's First Freedom, should be hitting your mailboxes here before long. Our friend Dave Kopel, the research director of the Independence Institute, has a fantastic article in the latest America's First Freedom called Freedom Fighters. And I'm a history buff. You know that. So it could be that Dave just, you know, was in my wheelhouse with this topic. But Dave writes about Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and their support for the right to keep and bear arms in the 19th century. In fact, it was really interesting. He says Frederick Douglass, in May of 1865, a month after the Civil War ended, or at least a month after Robert E. Lee's forces surrendered in Appomattox, Virginia, Frederick Douglass gave a speech called "In What New Skin Will the Old Snake Come Forth?" And Dave says, presciently, Douglass warned that the ex-slave states would attempt to impose all sorts of disabilities on the freedmen, as they had on free people of color before the Civil War. Frederick Douglass explained that abolishing slavery was not enough. There was a need for federal law to stop state and local governments from infringing on the freedmen's rights, especially the right to bear arms. I wonder if Hillary Clinton has ever read this speech, since she doesn't consider self-defense apparently to be a valid reason to keep and bear arms. And, of course, I think Hillary subscribes to that notion that, you know, throughout most of the United States' history, we didn't even think, our forefathers didn't even think that we had an individual right to keep and bear arms. It was all related to service in the militia, and outside of that, you know, nah, there was no right to own a gun. Well, apparently nobody told Frederick Douglass that. Without such legislation, again, federal law to protect state and local governments from infringing on the rights of the freed slaves, Frederick Douglass said, quote, "The legislatures of the South can take from him the right to keep and bear arms as they can." He said, "They would not allow a Negro to walk with a cane where I came from. They would not allow five of them to assemble together." He went on to say, "Notwithstanding the provision in the Constitution of the United States that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged, the black man has never had the right either to keep or bear arms." And he said, until there was a new amendment that would make states obey the prerogatives of the Second Amendment, he said, the work of the abolitionists is not finished. Here's a man who was born a slave in Maryland, who escaped slavery. His autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, was published in 1845. He was a guy who, again, had been working tirelessly, not just for the abolition of slavery, but for the rights of all Americans to be recognized as they were in the Constitution, but as they were not in many localities around the country. Dave also, again, talks about Harriet Tubman and her exercise of her right to keep and bear arms as she led slaves to freedom. It is again, Dave's a fantastic writer, but this piece is truly an excellent piece. Again, it's called Freedom Fighters. You can find it in your latest edition of America's First Freedom, the print magazine. You can also find it online at americasfirstfreedom.org. That's America's 1ST freedom.org. The article by Dave called Freedom Fighters. And again, if you're a lover of history, even if you're not, still well worth your time. All right, when we come back, we've got more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you, so stick around. We'll be right back here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums, the National Firearms Museum, what's it all about?
Well, you know, we got three museums now. We used to be the museum. Now we're three museums, and this is the home museum, the NRA National Firearms Museum. This is our 80th year of existence, and we are here at the NRA headquarters building. We've got about 3,000 firearms on display, and we have a number of spectacular new exhibits that have just popped up this past year. Usually it's exciting to get maybe one exhibit every other year, but this year we've got a great steampunks guns exhibit that shows fanciful guns that are artists' creations from steampunk fantasy. And then we compare those to actual guns from the Victorian era that kind of have the same sensibility about them and see if you can tell what's real and what's fake. We've also put in exhibits on America's pistol. And I'm very excited about this one. We have been able to reunite for the first time in a century the two actual pistols that did the head-to-head shootout in 1911 for the U.S. Army to pick their issue sidearm, the Savage Model 1911 45 ACP and the Colt Model 1911, both in 45 ACP, and of course the Colt won that head-to-head challenge. But these were the actual guns that were used in those trials, along with a number of other guns that were experimental models leading up to that.
All right, before we run out of time, how do folks get more information about the NRA National Firearms Museum?
Well, they can come visit us at the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. If they can't get by, they can come visit us on the website, nramuseums.com.
All right, Jim Sapieca, Director of the NRA Museums. That's the NRA National Firearms Museum here in Fairfax. Thank you for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club, but we also are being very serious about safety and training and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain
body types. A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Kurt Schlichter. I'm not sure if he's part of what makes a sweet dream, but he'll be with us on the program in just a little bit. The Virginia Shooting Sports Association tweeting out a link to a story just a couple minutes ago from the Herald Courier newspaper in Virginia. Governor Terry McAuliffe slated to hold a 1:30 p.m. press conference on Friday at the Virginia State Capitol to announce terms of this agreement between the governor and Republicans in the legislature. The Herald Courier reporting that, quote, an agreement in principle has been finalized for Virginia to maintain concealed handgun reciprocity or concealed carry reciprocity agreements with other states, apparently with all of the other states. The Herald Courier reports that GOP lawmakers in the McAuliffe administration have agreed to terms of an agreement to reverse Attorney General Mark Herring's action that would end concealed carry reciprocity agreements with 25 states on February the 1st. That formal announcement is expected on Friday. You know, I want to go back and see if I can find the comments by Attorney General Mark Herring. Here we go. December 22nd of 2015. This was, according to the Washington Post, Herring's move was, quote, part of a national push to circumvent legislatures opposed to tightening gun laws. Washington Post reported back in the end of December that Mark Herring, Democrat Attorney General, said 25 states have, quote, lax laws compared with Virginia, where a history of stalking, drug dealing, or inpatient mental health treatment can disqualify someone from carrying a concealed firearm. Herring's office at the time could not say how many people are suspected of crossing into Virginia with concealed weapons in order to commit crimes. I think the answer is zero. Republican lawmakers sharply criticized the move, they say, which the Post says enforces laws already on the books. This didn't enforce laws that were already on the books. This actually took agreements that have been made with 25 states and threw them out. But again, I don't expect the reporters covering this issue to have a whole lot of background on this type of information. But back in December, again, Mark Herring said, listen, this is great. This is great news. This is going to be a life-saving measure. This is going to be a public safety benefit, getting rid of these right-to-carry reciprocity agreements. The Post back in the end of December quoted Chelsea Parsons, vice president of guns and crime policy at the Liberal Center for American Progress, who said, quote, this has been where the gun violence prevention movement is going. I'm surprised she didn't use the phrase gun safety movement, but this is where the gun violence prevention movement is going. In much the same way President Obama said, I'm not going to wait for Congress anymore, the same can be said for leaders at the state level to really use their authority to take strong, meaningful steps on this issue. And here we are. A little more than a month later, month and a week, Governor McAuliffe is scheduled to hold a press conference again at the state capitol in Virginia, saying, "Never mind. We're not going to lose reciprocity with anybody." I have yet to see any comments from the Attorney General about this agreement between Governor McAuliffe and Republicans there in Richmond. The Washington Post quoted Chris Cox, executive director of the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action at the time, who called the decision, quote, both dangerous and shameful. At a time when people are scared and desperately need the ability to defend themselves, Herring has chosen the path of making self-defense harder. Senator Donald McEachin, Democrat from Henrico, said at the time, that the action by the Attorney General Mark Herring is, quote, a reflection of the law a conservative Republican legislator has crafted over the years. And now when the Attorney General actually follows the law, conservative Republicans are squealing about it. Yeah, I can tell Senator McEachin, I bet he knows by now. It wasn't just conservative Republican lawmakers who were squealing about the Attorney General's actions. A lot of Virginians were upset by this. Virginians who may be Republican, maybe Democrat, maybe independents, but they're concealed carry holders. And they're very upset that the Office of the Attorney General in the state of Virginia was used not to expand reciprocity with other states, but in fact to try to restrict reciprocity. The Washington Post said back in December Herring's move is in keeping with his embrace of liberal issues as he seeks a second term. Huh. What does this latest move say? Just out of curiosity. Coming a week and a day after the decision was announced, what is his latest move? Basically rescinding this action by the Attorney General. What does that say? You know, again, we talked with Dave Adams of the Virginia Shooting Sports Association earlier in the program, and I think, again, what it says is that you can have a former mayor in New York City telling you it's safe to go big on gun control, that he's got your back. He's got deep pockets, and he'll back you. But he doesn't vote in Virginia. I mean, I'm sure he could buy property. Heck, he could probably buy half of Virginia if he wanted to. But he's not a voter here. He's one guy. The big bank account, don't get me wrong. But he's one guy. And these lawmakers across the state of Virginia, when this move was announced, their phones started ringing and the emails started coming in. And they weren't getting a lot of communication from constituents saying, hey, you know what? We love this. This is a great move by Mark Herring. You don't do anything to touch this. You back off. No. No. Lawmakers got a lot of what the hell is going on there in Richmond, Virginia? And what do we have to do to turn this thing around? What can I do to ensure that this does not stand? And what can you do, Senator? What can you do, Delegate, to ensure that this does not stand? Because we didn't send you to Richmond to represent us so that you could roll over when our rights are restricted, when these agreements go away, including, as Dave Adams pointed out the last time we had him on the show earlier in the week, an agreement that Mark Herring's office had actually reached with the state of Kansas. They rescinded their own agreement. It was seen a month ago as a partisan political move. But it was one that the Attorney General and the Governor of Virginia thought that was a wise partisan political move. Again, they've been told, come on in, the anti-gun water is fine. America is ready for this. Your constituents are ready for this. They're not going to be upset about this at all. Oh, they were wrong. They were really wrong. And again, I'd love to, hopefully Mark Herring will be at that press conference tomorrow. Because I would love to hear the explanation by Mark Herring, the Attorney General, as to why it was these 25 states were bad yesterday, and now they're okay. Short of, again, this being a blatantly political move that had no public safety benefit to begin with, I'd really like to understand how the Attorney General could sign off on this, how the Attorney General could go along. Maybe the Attorney General will protest. After all, you know, he made the decision. Now we're hearing about Governor McAuliffe and the Republicans of the legislature making this agreement. So maybe Mark Herring will go toe-to-toe with Terry McAuliffe. You think that's likely to happen? No, I don't think that's likely to happen at all. Nor do I think it's likely that we're going to hear a real explanation from Virginia's Attorney General as to why these 25 states were awful yesterday, but they're cool today. Actually, they'll be cool at 1:30 p.m. tomorrow. What we will hear is that, we listened to lawmakers and we took concrete steps to improve Virginia's laws. The Herald Courier newspaper quotes Terry Kilgore, delegate from Gate City, Virginia. He says, it's a deal where nobody got everything they wanted, but we've agreed to voluntary, not mandatory, gun show background checks. Also, if you lose your concealed carry permit for any reason, you can't go to another state like Utah and get one. And if you have a permanent court-imposed domestic protective order, you can't get a permit. Those agreements that apparently Republicans have reached with Governor McAuliffe, yeah, I'll be really honest with you. They don't have anything to do with the rationale used by Mark Herring back on December 22nd when he made this announcement, right? Because the rationale that the anti-gun attorney general used was that we've got these dangerous people coming in from out of state. We've got these concealed carry holders coming in from these states where the laws are so lax that we can't recognize their permits because they're dangerous individuals when they come into this state carrying a concealed firearm. That was the actual rationale used for the action that the attorney general undertook. So what's his explanation going to be now? Again, I'm not confident we're actually going to get a real explanation. But it'll be interesting to see if any reporters at the press conference actually ask the attorney general if, in fact, he's in attendance there. All right, Kurt Schlichter, author of Conservative Insurgency, is going to join us. But, yeah, again, Virginia gun owners, thank you for speaking up and for speaking out. There's been a couple of instances over the past couple of months. You go back to the elections in November of 2015, Michael Bloomberg spent over $1 million here in the state of Virginia. He wanted to flip that state Senate, wanted to turn it anti-gun. Didn't get his wish. Again, because of the turnout of gun owners across the state, but particularly in Powhatan, Virginia, where you had incredibly strong turnout in an off-year election. And again, it wasn't long after that that we saw Terry McAuliffe announce his anti-gun executive actions. And then the Attorney General Mark Herring announces anti-gun moves. But it's fascinating that as we move closer to the presidential election across the country and here in Virginia, the anti-gunners seem to be taking a step back from their positions. How about that? Maybe the water is not so warm for the anti-gunners after all. All right, stick around. There is much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this quick timeout.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2002-2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard as snipers. They were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
When people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate, but for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military. There's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it, but it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right. So give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who have benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Without naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks again for joining us here on another edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, where the Taste of Farmville is tonight. Looks like I will be attending with my lovely bride. I know Kurt Schlichter is jealous. Aren't you, Kurt?
What's Farmville taste like?
It tastes like freedom.
I've been there.
Sweet, sweet freedom. And meatloaf. They've got a really good meatloaf at Charlie's.
Well, you took me out to one of your favorite restaurants. We had a blast.
We had a really
so
good
much
time.
Fun.
You know, I'm still going to get you down here for the vice presidential debate, which is going to be held in Farmville in October of this year. So you're coming down for that.
One of my many, many jury trials doesn't stop me.
Well, we'll just have to see if, you know, you'll win that case before it even gets to trial.
I hope it's more than that. You know, it's more than that. I'm double booked. Everybody wants a piece of the curd.
That does not surprise me. Have you, it sounds like things are going well for you. Just not enough hours in the day?
Well, that's because I'm a parasite of human misery. I'm a Los Angeles trial lawyer who defends companies being oppressed by these horrible, horrible job-killing laws.
And I'm sure that those companies appreciate you for being that L.A. trial lawyer, and a darn good one as well.
You know who I hope appreciates me? It's the guy just starting out who's going to work and has a job because I drove off some chiseler who wanted free money for nothing.
Well, let's talk about jobs for a second if we can, because there was a story that I had seen this earlier. We haven't had a chance to talk about it yet, and I kind of teased this earlier by saying there's a figure out here that to me is a really disturbing figure. Could indicate that maybe we're going to see violent crime continue to go up. It has nothing to do with gun ownership in this country, but Pew Research is reporting nearly 17% of young adults aged 16 to 29, Kurt, don't have a job, aren't going to school, or participating in employment training. A 10.2 million, quote, detached Americans, the phrases or the acronym is NEET, N-E-E-T, neither employed nor in education or training. 10.2 million Americans who are just sitting on their rear ends Maybe some of them are, maybe most of them are wanting to do something else, but they're not right now.
Well, you know, I mean, there are certain politicians who want to cultivate a class of the idle and indolent who aren't working and can live off government handouts, which, surprise, the liberals get to hand out to them. So, you know, I see people like us horrified by this. I see other people, you know, tenting their fingers going, excellent, future voters, I'll throw them a few scraps from my table and they will dance for me.
Well, you know, you're right. There are, I think, people out there who are horrified by this. I mean, I've got five kids. Two of my kids are in that 16 to 29 age range. Thankfully, both are gainfully employed. They are not neets. They're fairly neat people, but they're not neets. And I'm really glad that they're not neets. And frankly, I've raised my kids. My wife has raised our kids so that they would not want to be neets. You know, my daughter, our oldest child, is one of those people, like, if she has any free time, she's working two jobs right now, she's going to school in her spare time, and she still maintains, you know, hobbies and friendships. Like, I don't know how she finds the time to do it. She's even busier than you are, Kurt. But you have to want that.
Well, you know, I don't know. There are some people out there who like doing things. And there are other people out there who kind of want a free lunch. And I people like you and me, you know, you're always out doing things. We don't get that. Unfortunately, some politicians have discovered that this is a constituency that they can get in cahoots with. And suddenly, you know, hey, you know, you don't have to do anything and I'll make excuses for you. And, you know, I'll, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I'll arrange some payoffs because, you know, you're a victim. Yeah, you're a victim. That's the ticket. The other thing is minimum wage hikes don't help. I mean, you know, this $15 an hour nonsense, I got news for you. I pay people money. And, you know, some of the tasks around the office are not worth $15 an hour to me. You may be a very nice person, but you are worth the value I get as the employer out of your work. And if I don't get that value, you know, you're not getting that job. That's just the way it is. I'm not a welfare system.
If you were, you would.
I'd be a very efficient one.
You would be.
The community gruel pie.
Indeed you would be. But, you know.
I'm hungry. Great. There's some gruel. It's cold because warm food's for closers.
But
Mitch and Murray sent me from downtown. That's who I am.
But Pew says,
you know, I think and you laugh and it's harsh. I was going off on Twitter with some guy going, you know, what are we going to do about children who are hungry? And I'm like, who's we? What are their parents going to do? And don't give me this long torture thing. Well, you know, he's an orphan who was struck by lightning. That's not the reality. The reality is a lot of people are bums. And we always means me. It always means I take care of my kids, and then I got to take care of some bum's kids. No one ever asked the bum to do his job. Hey, maybe you ought to get off the couch and go out and support your freaking kids. Maybe you ought to stop looking at me, because it's easier to guilt me into supporting somebody else's kids than to look at somebody who's being lazy and stupid and making bad decisions and say, hey, maybe you ought not to get drunk every night. Maybe you ought to clean yourself up, take a shower, get a shave, go down the street to the freaking Burger King, get the sign off the door and say, I want to hand out burgers. And I'm going to work my way up from fries to register to manager, and I'm going to support my family. But it's a lot easier to look at us and go, what are you going to do? Hey, don't talk to me. I'm doing.
Well,
don't talk to the bum.
But again, I mean, what you're talking about, you're right. It is absolutely easier to say, well, what are you, Mr. L.A. trial lawyer, going to do?
Nothing. I'm not going to do anything.
No, I'd actually say you're wrong.
Government-wise.
You're wrong, L.A. trial lawyer. Oh, yeah, government-wise, you're right. But here's what I think you do, Kurt, and here's what I think, you know, we need to see more of in this country is We need to talk more, frankly, about the dignity of work, right?
Exactly.
You know, I mean,
and insist on it.
It doesn't matter that you are. I've had this conversation with my kids when they reach the age that you know, they want a job and they want to have some spending money and they want to put gas in their car. They want to save up for a car. there are jobs that they just didn't want to do, right? Like, I'm not going to go work at McDonald's. And I've asked my kids, why not? Well, it's fast
what,
food.
They're better than me?
So what?
I worked at McDonald's.
Right.
I worked at McDonald's for 14 months. If you're saying I'm too good to work at McDonald's, you're saying, Kurt, I'm better than you. Oh, really? You're better than me? You're too good to soil your hands with Big Mac sauce? You know, it's funny. I went down, I talked to the Newport Beach Republican women. And this is Newport Beach, California. These are rich people. I mean, John Bolton's hanging out in the lobby of this club that I was at. There's 200, and they are super rich people. And they get up and they read my bio. Now, I'm 50 years old, and I've been able to do some stuff. So it was a very nice bio. And I said, you guys, you know, you're talking about me being a colonel and a writer and a lawyer. And that's all great, but that's not who Kurt Schlichter is. Kurt Schlichter is the guy who mopped out toilets at Carl's Jr. restaurant for $3.10 an hour. That's who I am. And tell me, people, isn't that who a lot of you guys are? And the place just came apart. They were like, hell yeah, that's where I started. You know, a few of them were probably born to money, but not most of them. Most of them got to that club. They got there in a Mercedes because they started out mopping out toilets at a Carl's Jr. or the equivalent for minimum wage.
Well, I'll give you a perfect example of this. There was a story I read today. We're going to try to get the owner of this company on, Tedder Enterprises, and Mr. Tedder, I can't remember his first name. They make holsters. They're in Idaho. They just bought, Kurt, an outlet mall that was basically sitting vacant, and that's going to be their new manufacturing facility. They employ 300 people. This guy is 38 years old. He started his company making holsters at his kitchen table in Fort Smith, Arkansas. That was how he started, and this is how far he's grown in just a few short years.
I know, and it can be done. Look, I was, I wrote in college. I wrote jokes during the 90s, you know, when you went to bars.
Has Amy Schumer ever used any of your jokes, just out of curiosity?
Did who?
Amy Schumer.
Yeah. She stole all my bits. That's funny. She's like Dane Cook without the... No, she is Dane Cook. But you know, and then I started writing again. I wrote a few things for Breitbart, and I've worked up. And, you know, today I'm going to do an hour on the panel with Dr. Drew. So you can, you know, you can either not watch watch Donald Trump not be at the debate, or you can watch me on Dr. Drew talk about Donald Trump not being at the debate. So you got a choice there. but the point is, you know, I mean, I started out doing stuff and I got better. People like what I'm doing. They give me money for it. They ask me to be on TV. And I didn't just go, hey, I'm awesome. Come on, do these things. I worked. I earned it. And everybody, but the thing is, you can do that. People have different talents. I wouldn't know how to make a holster, you know, work with leather. I couldn't do that. I'd end up, you know, driving an awl through my hand. But everybody has their own talents. And you can, if you use it in your decade, you're probably going to succeed. The odds are in your favor if you work hard, learn how to do something well. The odds are in your favor. Why don't you play that hand? Instead of sitting there and whining, you know, everybody hates me, I can never do anything, deck stacked against me, deck stacked against everybody. And in the end, we all lose. We all die. So, you know,
this is going to be a fascinating hour-long discussion with Dr. Drew. It sounds like you're going to be very esoteric tonight, Kurt.
Oh, yeah.
In the end, we're all winners and we're all losers, Dr. Drew.
Whoa.
So I've got to ask, we've got a couple of minutes here. Are you enjoying the TV appearances?
You know, it's interesting, and it's fun. I wrote about it a while ago at IJ Review, what happens on them, because I didn't know. I didn't know how to be on TV. I didn't know how to be on your show. I learned a lot about it, by the way, by being on your show, how to do it, how not to talk over the host, how to try and go where you want to go because you kind of – well, I know you well enough that I don't necessarily let you run my segments. Sometimes we go in Kurt's direction, but that's because we're friends.
Right.
I enjoy it. It's fun, and I don't have a shame gene, so I'm not shy.
Well, that's true.
That's certainly true. But, no, it's interesting, and I'm just egotistical enough to think that I have a perspective that other people might want to hear. I mean, who wants a trial lawyer who thinks, what I say doesn't matter. I mean, look, talk to the air guy. No, nobody wants that trial lawyer.
I imagine those are not the successful trial lawyers out there, right? The ones who
Mr. Jones, would you like to give your closing argument? No, pass.
No, That's okay. You guys probably have figured it out, right? That's,
you guys are good, right?
Need to be a little more assertive than that, is what you're saying.
Please stop mumbling, Mr. Schlichter.
Well, I will say I get a kick out of watching you on TV, and I don't watch a lot of – frankly, I don't watch a lot of the news channels. I don't watch a lot of TV generally. But when I see that you are going to be on, I do try to make an effort to watch. I like to watch my friends on television. And what's fun about you is that, you know, you're right. And I think you do the same thing when you're on this program. Like you say, you don't really let – we don't always go in the direction that I would like the interview to go. but you have such a finite capacity for BS. And a lot of – frankly, a lot of the talking head television is primarily BS. And so when you get a nonsense question, I think you're not only do you disregard it, but you actually bat it right back in the host's face. And I actually like that. I like watching that.
Like a Don Lemon?
I wasn't going to mention any names, but sure, we can say Don Lemon.
I have not been on it. I have not been back on that show.
I didn't say the other hosts out there liked watching this or liked it happening to them. I just said I like watching it as a viewer. I like watching it. But that's Don's loss, frankly.
Well, you know, the other shows have been very, you know, Dr. Drew's always very eager to have me on. They're very nice. Well, everybody's very nice on the shows, by the way.
That's what
the producers are always nice. The staffs are always very nice. It's really, you know, it's a pleasant experience. And they're pros. Like you guys, when I go to your studio, I like to watch because you guys are just good at it. You're good at something that I don't really know how to do. And, you know, especially like watching you up there, you're as smooth as silk. You just know how to do this because you've done it so well.
No, you keep talking, sweet talker.
I know,
we'll
baby.
We'll have you back on anytime.
It's just, I like seeing people who are good at what they do. And it's a lot of fun because it's a real skill. It's not one that I have. I think I'm a good guest. I'd be a terrible host. I don't. That's because the time I've guest hosted for you, you've always made sure there's like two other guys there, which is like hugely smart. It's like this, I was like, God, these guys are smart.
That's in case we have to, you know, go to the dump button, right? If you just go up in this profanity lace tirade, we've got a couple of people who can step up there and
exactly.
And finish
got
off the job.
Tough guys going, don't say any of these words.
Exactly.
Here's a list.
All right, listen, buddy, we're almost out of time, but I'm glad to know that you'll be on Dr. Drew tonight. When life gives you lemon, of course, you make lemonade. When life does not give you Don Lemon, you go on Dr. Drew. So
exactly.
I think that's how the saying goes, right?
Exactly. And I will be there for CPAC, so we will hang out.
Excellent.
And the weekend before, I'm doing Greg Gutfeld's show in New York.
Oh, fantastic. All right, well, listen, keep us apprised of your many travels and your many appearances, and we'll talk again soon.
It'll be fun. Talk to you soon.
Kurt Schlichter joined us. Buy his book, Conservative Insurgency. That's something that Dr. Drew Pinsky will never tell you. And in the meantime, we only have about, 20 seconds or so left. That music means it is almost time to go. But the good news is we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. We're going to talk with our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. Catherine Mortensen from NRA ILA going to join us in studio. We'll have the latest legislative news from around the country, including Virginia, where Governor McAuliffe and Republicans apparently making an agreement regarding right to carry reciprocity. And it looks like Attorney General Mark Kerry, the odd man out on that one. We'll see you tomorrow with NRA News, Cam and Company.